expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
The following feature has been rated R by the Motion Picture Association of America. It is intended for mature audiences and parental discretion is advised.
If this station's not your cup of tea...
Then drink coffee!
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 Drink coffee!
100% news.
100%
information.
100% guarantee.
Thought you might say that.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
The competition has taken notice.
Oh my God!
Good luck keeping up with us.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
ZTalk Radio is committed to bringing you the best radio possible. We will test your senses with innovative and entertaining radio programming. Honest, informative, inspirational, and on occasion, controversial. Our listening audience will also have the opportunity to interact with the show hosts and guests through live chat and call-in capabilities. You can't be left out of the loop. Tune into all our live shows once, and you'll never turn your computer off again. ZTalk Radio on your computer dial. Your healthy addiction.
On the go and missing another one of your favorite ZTalk shows? Now you don't have to. Simply go to the Google Play Store on your Android phone and download the ZTalk Radio app. The best part is, it's absolutely free. That's ZTalk Radio. Only found in your Google Play Store on your Android phone. Download it today.
Commencing excision system check. Treble. Online. Mid-range. Online. Bass. Unacceptable. Increasing bass level.
Like any you've ever heard. This is not your grandma's radio station. You're tuned into ZTalkRadio.com. Place of open minds, varied opinions, and free speech. You're tuned into Chris Davis and Jenny Gurney, and this is Valley Ghost Hunting. Chris Davis and Jenny Gurney.
Hey, it's Wednesday. It's 5 o'clock, and I need to check something here, make sure it's working right. Yeah, I had to turn on what you hear because it was hooked up for the other sound card. Maybe the same exact thing, but for some reason it's saving this one as number 2. Nah. So I had to make sure that the what you hear was turned on.
It would be nice.
Yeah. I swear, it's retarded.
So how are you guys doing?
Oh, just sitting here sucking coffee out of my new coffee mug.
So how was the trip?
Well, for everybody who didn't see the other day, and you can get all jealous if you want, because a lot of people are, we went to Antique Archaeology, you know, the place that the guys from American Pickers are on. And I'm a little annoyed.
Yeah, it's because he didn't get to see Danielle.
Yeah, Danielle's only there when they're filming. The rest of the time she works out of her home.
Would you stay in there, that building, by yourself?
What do you mean it's by herself? There's open. Like a staff of like 10 people.
I know, I'm just kidding.
It's open every day, so...
Well, good
for
her.
They're open every day, except this Sunday they weren't open because it was Easter.
Easter...
Well, we already have our guest on the line with us. Daniel, you still there?
I'm still here.
Would you like to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. I currently am living in Northern California, and I work primarily as a digital artist and teacher. One thing that I've done in past years is I've had a good interest in ancient history and especially with ancient American history and archaeology of Central America and places like that. So I've done a good bit of research about those areas, visited and studied those, and written a couple of books about that. But I've actually been, this year and last year, I've been guest on a number of different talk shows related to paranormal topics. Paranormal or spiritual topics, usually. And what I've been doing is I've been explaining the Mormon point of view on a lot of these topics, because they're very, very fascinating. I've been interested in all kinds of similar topics since I was a child growing up in Florida, and found them very interesting and kind of tried to follow along with them. So I've, you know, heard all kinds of explanations and experiences, and we see, you know, recently there's a great deal of interest in a number of shows dedicated to these sorts of topics. And what I've done is I've been sharing quite a bit, I guess, the beliefs and the teachings that Mormons have concerning these kinds of topics, because I felt that it would be, you know, interesting to sort of add to the discussion. And I found that a good deal of people, you know, have been interested to hear what that might be, and don't really know, you know, what our take on these things might be. So that's about it, really quickly, I guess.
Yeah, you really don't hear about a lot of Mormons who are into the paranormal. The only one that I can really think of, and he actually left, is Grant from Ghost Hunters.
Right, and I, for the longest time, did not know that about him. But, yeah, so Ghost Hunters is sort of like, you know, was the major one for quite a while. I don't recall all these shows being on until after that show was on. So I thought it was interesting since, you know, I don't know that there's a whole lot of us out there doing these types of investigations, but I thought it would be good to kind of add our beliefs into the mix and to sort of see, you know, see how that goes.
Yeah. See, I didn't know he was Mormon until I just happened to be looking one day on IMDb, and I want to doing a little background on him, and it's like, holy crap, he's Mormon? No way!
Yeah. I didn't know that either until I was actually the guest on a show called Spooky South Coast, which is a paranormal show based in Massachusetts. And we were talking about this, and the host mentioned that to me, and that's how I found out.
Did you watch the tweet?
There was a show called Spooky South Coast that was from Massachusetts, you say?
A radio show.
That's funny, because the South Coast is kind of like down in my area.
Well, this was they explain it as it's the South Coast around the Massachusetts area. So there's a place there called the South Coast.
Gotcha.
I guess there's probably a lot of South Coasts somewhere. I mean,
that one just...
where I'm from is the Gulf Coast. And that's about as almost as south as you can get.
Yep.
Yeah, what was that one? Central Coast Paranormal. They're out of, like, Michigan. And I'm sitting there going, coast in Michigan? Oh, wait a minute, Great Lakes. Duh.
Exactly. There's a lot of coast around there.
That doesn't count. That's fresh water.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's true. Yeah, I guess that's a shore, not a coast.
Yeah, it's not a coast. There you go. It's fresh water. It's a shore. So what is some of, like, the major differences that you've noticed between, say, Mormons and just, you know, regular Christians having to do with the paranormal?
With paranormal? Well, first of all, we do consider ourselves Christians, although there are some that don't. You know, there are some differences between us and other Christian faiths, but we do consider ourselves Christians. As far as with the paranormal, how that goes, we have some very specific doctrines and beliefs about this area. And in addition to the Bible, we have other scriptures, books that we consider scripture as well as the Bible, that kind of give us a bit more information. And I think these are things that all kinds of people, you know, wonder about. You know, what happens when we die, or you know, where did we come from? Was there something before? So one thing that I would say is we have a lot of specific beliefs about spirits, about what spirits are. We believe that everyone has a spirit, and indeed all living things have a spirit. So that would include animals. So there was a spiritual creation before there was a physical creation. And in the book of Genesis, in the very beginning, there kind of seem to be two creation accounts. And biblical scholars have kind of thought that perhaps these were two different accounts, one older and one not so old, that somehow got jumbled together. Our belief is that one account is a spirit creation, and that one account is a physical creation. And these are both necessary. And that our spirits, yours, mine, everyone's, these are eternal. And our spirits lived before our birth here on this earth. And so our mortal lives from birth to death is just one tiny little part of our entire eternal existence. And so at death, the spirit separates from the body and continues living in a place that we refer to as the spirit world. And that this is a time where you'll be rejoined with others that, you know, relatives and past loved ones that have gone on before. It's also a time where there's work to be done, and where people can, if they haven't done so well in this life or haven't learned what they needed to, there is the opportunity for them to learn some more and to progress. And that this would be a necessary thing that would have to happen before the final resurrection.
Yeah.
So there's something right there that would, I think, perhaps have a lot of implication with the idea of, you know, paranormal theories regarding spirits and ghosts and death and so on. So that's, you know, that's one thing that comes to my mind, off the top of my head.
Yeah, I had actually, I lived in Oregon, oh God, about 9 years ago, and had actually had some Mormons coming over about once a week, and we would sit there for about an hour or two and just talk. And but it,
what that is, was, were these missionaries?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was.
Yeah, I was a missionary many years ago in Argentina.
That was before I had actually started investigating the paranormal. I was just doing research. And my ex always thought it was funny that I would sit there and talk religion with them for like an hour or two, because at the time I was atheist.
Mm-hmm.
So me sitting there talking religion with two Mormons kind of boggled her mind.
Well, an open-minded atheist and an open-minded Christian of any faith should be able to have a conversation.
I think so, yeah. And learn from each other, perhaps.
Exactly. It's all about learning.
Mm-hmm.
But see, I think they had been coming over for like a year, and I never at any point actually told them I was an atheist.
Uh-huh. And they hadn't quite figured it out?
No. Because, see, even though I'm an atheist, I still studied religion. I used to read about, you know, Islam, Judaism, all of them. And now I actually write a magazine article for Paranormal Underground about religion and the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd actually love to have you on to do an interview about it, because I haven't found any Mormons yet willing to actually talk about the paranormal.
Right. Well, you know, I'd be happy to do that. That's actually what I've been doing, in addition to everything else, for the past year or so. And maybe this was just sort of my own idea, but I thought, you know, I think we have some particular beliefs and doctrines that, you know, are different and could be very helpful in the whole sort of paranormal discussion. And so that's kind of been my thing that I've been discussing out there. So I'd be happy to do more of that.
Yeah, the Mormon religion seems more open to the paranormal than any other Christian religion does.
Yeah, I think so, especially when you look at the origins and Joseph Smith and his talk about visions and angels and being taught by heavenly messengers and kind of this, more this open conduit to the world beyond, which really was, you know, extremely unacceptable, especially in his day. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that we, you know, should have a lot to add to this discussion.
But see, that's one thing I don't understand. You know, so many other religions don't want to talk about that stuff, yet in their own books they talk about angels and demons, but, you know, a lot of people, oh, well, that stuff doesn't exist. Like, it's in your Bible. Come on.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if it's in there, it's there for a reason, and if it was important a long time ago, it should still be important today.
Yeah, well, a lot of stuff that's written in the Bible they don't follow anymore. Like, women shall be silent in church.
Yeah, we're not silent anywhere anymore.
Yeah, no, and that's a good thing.
But, you know, in every Christian religion, there's always the Father, who is an omnipotent God. He's a being. Mm-hmm. There's the Son, who was conceived of immaculate birth. There's the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, or the Holy Ghost. There's the, you know, Immaculate Conception. There's a lot of things that don't make sense on a, you know, a human, for what we know now, level. So it was
exactly.
So, and there are talks of angels and the ones that were cast down, and so, you know, it seems like everybody would be. Of course, I'm a Pollyanna like this. I think everybody should be open to at least hear what somebody else has to say. And respect it, if not believe it.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. You know, I think that a lot of our problems and disagreements and misunderstandings would be alleviated if we just all did that.
I saw an article the other day, and now I don't even remember where it was, that the next great flood is coming because the humans on Earth have, you know, taken to each other and tearing religion apart, and so I'm like, okay, let's get an ark. We need a big boat.
Of course, I seem to recall that with Noah's story at the end, that God promised that he would never again destroy the earth by water. So maybe it's a flood or something else.
Ooh. As long as it's not locusts or frogs, I'm good.
Yeah.
Lava!
I think that would be pretty horrible.
It's going to be lava!
Lava?
Lava! The supervolcano under Yellowstone is going to explode, and the Earth will be covered in lava.
Okay, that'll work.
Yeah, that would wake people up, I guess.
You watch too much Doomsday Preppers.
No, that's science. At one point, that volcano will explode, and 3/4 of the North America will be gone.
Well, the New Madrid Fault could go here in Tennessee, and that would take us out. But that's a flood. But it would be caused by an earthquake. I think too much. I'm sorry.
Yes.
But yeah, that's if the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints, do believe in a spirit world, do you think that with that possibility that it's conceivable that they could overlap at any given time?
Overlap. Well, our belief is that the spirit world is actually here. that's here upon the earth, and we kind of refer to it as going, you know, beyond the veil. Mm-hmm. So there's a veil between our mortal eyes and, you know, what lies beyond. So we definitely do believe that there could be some overlapping, or that, you know, at times, you know, we have a saying that you know, the veil is very thin, meaning that, you know, there's some influence felt from that spirit world by, you know, people that have gone before, or that our family or our ancestors perhaps can watch over and see us and in some ways give us some hint or some guidance or direction if we're needing that, or if there's, you know, there's some particular message that we might have. But that certainly is a possibility. It's something that would, you know, happen, of course, within, you know, God's great overriding plan. Mm-hmm. And we certainly are against what would be seen as a direct attempts to try and communicate with the spirit world that will fall in the area of Ouija boards and mediums and, you know, ghost writing and any types of things like that. That it usually doesn't happen that way, that if there's some message that needs to get here, that would come from, you know, that spirit world to us.
Nice, thank you.
Not used to that.
But yeah,
sound.
We believe it is a very real thing, and a very real place, and that you know, there is work there still to be done,
mm-hmm.
and that you know, it's nothing really to be feared, especially if you live your life in the best way that you can and do the best you can. That, you know, there's nothing nothing to fear. Now, I've spoken to people that have had near death experiences, and I've read about this type of thing a lot because I find it very interesting. And I think what's interesting is that there seems to be kind of a common thread running through them, no matter what their beliefs are or expectations are, you know, about coming into a place, about meeting a being of pure love or pure light and, mm-hmm. and not wanting to come back. And so, you know, we would probably, you know, describe it in some similar ways. Anything else about that you'd like me to talk about?
Cheryl's kind of sitting, or Cheryl and Jenny are talking about something, and I'm trying to catch up. But
John Zappas.
No, talk about Daniel being a good question and answer for the magazine.
Oh.
I'm going to. I already planned it, Cheryl. God. I keep trying to call her Teresa.
She's talking to him.
My brain go, eh.
Don't pay attention to the chat. You have a guest on the phone.
You know, Teresa, you know him. He has ADD, so.
I have ADHD. Be happy I'm not sitting here staring at the squirrels outside. They're out picking up all the deer corn, so. But, yeah, now, what's the biggest differences between Mormonism and other Christian religions dealing with the paranormal? Like, the biggest, besides... Well, actually, no. I didn't read all of the Book of Mormon. I actually used to have a copy of it, but I didn't get to mm-hmm. read all of it. How does that focus on demons compared to the Bible?
Well, it doesn't really, and I'd like to, you know, I'd like to take that and go into, you know, a related topic, and that's the idea of demons. Now, I would personally say that I don't think there's any such thing as demons. Demons is a word that's not found in the Bible, but there are evil spirits, and we believe that since we all lived before we were born, all of us who are children of God lived as spirit children. There was another one of these spirit beings there whose name was Lucifer, and that he actually rebelled against our father's plan and tried to set up one of his own, which is not accepted, and he and his followers were cast out. And of course, you know, many Christian religions would have some type of similar beliefs as this. So our belief is that he is a spirit in the same way that we are spirits, or we have spirits, but that he will never be born have a physical body. So he and his followers were cast out of the presence of God and have come to this earth. And that they are here, and they've been here from the beginning. Their purpose is to tempt us and to make our lives miserable, but to, worse, to try and get us to pull away from God and to make decisions that would take us away from the path that we should be. So we don't really speak of demons, but there are evil spirits who, and Satan really is not a name, it's a term. It means adversary. He is our adversary. He's the deceiver. And so his whole point is to be our adversary in this life. So these evil spirits are, you know, all around trying to get mankind to, you know, do bad things in life, to make wrong choices, but also to try and subvert, you know, God's plan. The Book of Mormon doesn't have a whole lot specifically about this, but there are some very specific things in it that talk about spirits and the spirit world and what happens between death and resurrection. So those are some specific things found in the Book of Mormon. And as far as, you know, these evil spirits, you know, there would be other teachings and other scriptures we have that would tend to explain more about that.
Yeah, it seems to me that, and, you know, some people might not like this comparison, but that Mormonism is more like Buddhism in some ways when it pertains to other religions, you know, who cares, just don't be a prick, than other Christian religions are, where we must convert you or you will go to hell. And
well, I mean, obviously, if you think about missionaries, you know, Mormons and their missionary force, that's, you know, that's kind of the main thing people have in mind about us. And so as far as, you know, the conversion process and trying to share our beliefs, we believe that that is very important, but we don't believe, certainly, that people who aren't Mormons are going to hell. That's not within our faith.
You teach people about your religion. You don't.
Well, we do.
You don't go around and try and convert everybody.
Well, our belief is that one person really can't convert another. The true conversion comes from God. True conversion is the Holy Spirit that touches our spirits directly and shows us what the truth is. So that's our take on it. I can't convert anyone. That really is something that is between that person and God.
Well, missionary work basically is to spread the word about your religion, because if you don't pass it on and other people don't convert into your religion, it will die out in a short period of time, in just a couple mm-hmm. of generations. If you only have the children of your current members going to church and not telling people about their religion or trying to share it, your religion is dead.
We believe that a missionary effort is, you know, is one thing that we're supposed to do. That was, you know, Christ's last sort of commandment to his apostles, you know, to go and preach the word and baptize in every land, and
right.
that still stands.
Yes.
Go ahead. I attend. A church occasionally. A good friend of mine is a standing member, and they are Old Testament preachers. They rarely speak anything out of the New Testament, so it's a little out there for me, but I always get a message. But they have one of the largest missionary outreach plans in the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they do prison ministries in South America. I think Haiti was one of their big places that they went, and actually do a lot of conversions. But these people that they speak to are desperate
mm-hmm.
for some salvation.
Yeah, that sounds like important work, certainly. And I think that's something that I think all of us, no matter where we are or where we're from, we have some innate questions and things that we could use some direction on. I think people mm-hmm. all, even if they want to, whether they admit it or not, are looking for some type of spiritual direction or some type of spiritual answers. And I think that you know, perhaps in these recent years, the great interest in paranormal investigations and activity might kind of be a part of that. There are people looking for answers. And there are many mysteries about life, things we wonder about or things that we witness and go, gosh, what is that? I can't explain it. And so I think that's, you know, that's one way of trying to answer these questions.
I believe you're absolutely correct. if you don't question, you know, if you don't have people out there giving you different options, your questions don't ever go answered. They'll, you know, and that leads to a lot of confusion. So a missionary would, you know, certainly give you something to think about. If you had questions, you can ask someone of the Mormon faith. You can ask someone of the Baptist faith. You know, just follow on down the line. If you don't ask the questions, you don't ever get an answer.
Yeah, that's true. One thing I was thinking was that, you know, in the past year or so, I think Mormons have been more on people's mind than before because of the recent presidential race, you know, mm-hmm. where we had the prospect of almost having a Mormon president. And, of course, that brought up all kinds of things that people were saying. And it seemed like people, you know, one thing was Mormons are so mysterious and they're so strange and no one knows what they believe and what is it really all about. And my thought was, well, I'm sure everyone knows someone who's a Mormon. Just go, hey, you know, what are you all about? What's, you know, what's important to you? It's not that mysterious. All you have to do is find someone to ask, and we'd be glad to, you know, to try and answer the questions.
I would think that you could probably hit any street corner. We have missionaries here in my hometown. And actually, my sister garnered a lot of comfort from the two missionaries that came, and she actually did convert to the Mormon faith. She had spent a lot of time questioning faith and questioning herself and her purpose. And they gave her, like I said, they gave her a lot of comfort, and they would sit and talk with her for hours.
Mm-hmm.
Until she finally did go to their church and after a while convert. And I always thought that that was a very compassionate, because these were young men, you know.
That's what I did at the age of 19, you know, left my home, and I was called to go to Argentina, a place I'd never been before, and, you know, served like that for 2 years. But I think a lot of people have questions. With my mother, she actually became a Mormon when I was about 3 years old. And we were from the South, and so she was raised with very traditional Christian teachings and beliefs. But she always had questions that her ministers could not answer, and she wondered these things, and kind of were always on her mind. And she said, you know, this is where she found, you know, the answers. Everything she'd ever been wondering about, that's where she found the answers. And so I think that leads people to seek things out, whether mm-hmm. they're looking for traditional religion or non-traditional or other things, you know, even like, say, looking in paranormal research. It, you know, the questions lead people to, hopefully, will lead people to do something about that. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, here in Tennessee, growing up, you have the Baptist Church, you have the Methodist Church, and you have the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And the Baptists didn't go to the Methodist Church, and the Methodists didn't go to the Baptist Church. Luckily, I had cousins that were Catholic, so I did get to attend a few masses when we were smaller. But, you know, you don't ever learn anything about it. So, you know, we'd go and visit the Baptist Church. Occasionally, they had get-togethers after football games. And it always seemed so strange that they would give a message at a high school party after a football game. And, it, you know, at that time in junior high and high school, what they spoke about was so different, because my mom was a Methodist church. Or a Methodist member, and the Methodists didn't believe what and you know, you never knew why the Methodists don't believe what the Baptists believe.
Yep.
Or why the So it's interesting to me to actually go to different churches and learn something.
And I think that's, you know, whatever moves you, whatever, you know, your questions or your need in life take you, you know, I say you should follow it. For my mother, her questions were always, you know, about what, you know, what are angels? What are spirits? What happens when we die? These were things that were on her mind even from the time of being a child. And she could never find good answers, you know, to that. You know, what are angels like? What is God really like? And so she, you know, finally found the answers that, mm-hmm. you know, she was looking for much later.
Yeah, my mom passed away a couple of years ago, and I always, right after she did, I was like, Mom, are there really pearly gates, and are you walking down that street of gold with, you know, the people, you know, angels playing music on harps, and your aged ill body falls away and you're healthy forever? It's like, you know, if that's the story, I can fall behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that that's where she is. But I also hope I hope that her mother is there too, because she missed her an awful lot. I think that's what it happens with some of the other Christian, the mainstream Christian churches, is that that's the story, and that's what, you know, and a lot of people can't buy that.
Right. Well, you know, we actually don't have quite the, you know, sitting on the cloud playing harps for eternity. We believe there are many great works and things for us to do. But we do say that whenever someone does pass beyond the veil, from this life into the next, that they are greeted, and that they'll be greeted with someone that they would have known in life, and there will be a great reunion of loved ones. And so that is something certainly to look forward to.
Mm-hmm. And certainly in the Methodist Church, we didn't talk about paranormal activity.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I can see where in some Christian cultures that might be almost like a forbidden topic.
Mm-hmm. It just wasn't brought up.
Mm-hmm. See, and you know, that's one thing I find funny, is that somebody, oh, well, ghosts don't exist because, you know, the Bible says you were sent for judgment. Yet when Jesus was resurrected, the verse, fear not, for I am not a ghost. It is me, Jesus.
That's right. And what did he say? He said, touch me. I've got, you know, I'm physical. I have flesh and bones. Mm-hmm. Here, let me eat some honeycomb. Let me eat some fish. But it's interesting that when his disciples, his apostles first saw him and he appeared to them in that closed room, they thought he was a spirit. They were afraid.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe you can't quite tell a spirit from, let's say, a real or resurrected individual right at the moment. And Jesus had to explain to them, here's what has happened. So, I mean, and, you know, he cast out many evil spirits during his ministry. The Bible is full of talk of spirits of all sorts.
Yeah. See, like you were talking earlier about... Teresa, you know, the Baptists didn't talk to the Methodists and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I find it funny that so many of them argue over who's right, yet they all read the same Bible.
But they all interpret it differently and follow different parts of it.
Yep, yeah. That's very true.
But if you don't, you know, and I guess what I was trying to get to is it's generational here. If you step outside of your church upbringing, you know, I went to a Methodist church for the longest time because that's where my mom went. When I got old enough to drive and get out on my own, I started going to other places. But, you know, it's kind of sad. You say that you're not, you know, you can point fingers and say you're not right. How do you know? If you don't go and attend a service and talk to people and find out what they believe, you can't say they're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I think that Mormons especially are kind of particularly sensitive about is people telling others what we believe, because usually they get it wrong. We would rather explain, well, no, here's what we really believe. But it is interesting how you have all these Christian religions and churches have the Bible, yet they can't quite come together on some issues. I hope I'm not saying something too controversial when I say that I think the Bible doesn't really answer a lot of the questions people have. That there's a lot of stuff in there that we might want to know that it's just not there. And so in the absence of that, you know, good, decent people have, you know, come up with their own interpretations or religious doctrines. And I think that kind of explains where we, you know, where things have ended up today. Because people, each one with his own different, you know, background or understanding or point of view, could look at the same teaching and come up with a different interpretation. That's just the nature of mankind, I think.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, and in eras past, the church became so politicized that, you know, it was kind of if the priest or the pastor or the minister or the father doesn't, if he says this is wrong, it's wrong. That's a means of control.
Right.
That's a means to control a populace. And I don't happen to think that that's what Christianity is all about.
That certainly was not the message that Jesus gave. But when you look at, say, the history of medieval Europe and what happened when people sort of tried, you know, had a different idea other than the prevailing church at the time, which, of course, was the Catholic Church, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be a very, you know, Christ-like response. You know, burning and persecuting people who disagree or who are trying to, you know, point out their point of view. Or, you know, being so involved with kings and nations and wars and that type of thing. So I think it's important to try and get back to, you know, what was the message that, that Jesus was trying to tell us, and what was the message that his apostles were, you know, trying to bring out, you know, in those early days. I think that, you know, the true Christian message is one that is maybe a lot harder to live than many Christians would really really realize. Especially, you know, loving your neighbor and doing good to those that, that persecute you. That's not an easy thing.
Yeah, love your neighbor doesn't exactly seem to fit in well with modern-day Christians.
Or even, I think I misspoke, I mean, love your enemies. I mean, that's what Christ would tell you, love your enemies. That's, you know, I don't see a whole lot of that happening. That's a tough thing. I mean, I try and follow that, but, you know, it's not our automatic nature to do that.
We don't even try to understand our enemies anymore, let alone
right
in the big picture, you know. Oh, they're Muslims, we don't like them, you know. That's come on.
Right,
the people that are over there fighting, they're fighting for what they believe into. We're mm-hmm. fighting for oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't even try to understand anymore. We don't look and see that a lot of people are doing the same things that we're doing just to survive. They're all working. They're all raising their kids, coming home on the afternoons and watching a paranormal show, and they go to bed, and tomorrow they wake up and do it all again. They just do it a little bit differently than we do.
Right. So, yeah, the trick, I think, is to try and stand up for what you believe in and share it, but to do so in a way that is loving and is respectful, and where you don't fall into the, you know, you're wrong, so I'm going to, you know, not respect you or not even try to understand you at all. I don't think that gets us anywhere.
Yeah, and, you know, that keys into the paranormal community right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
lot of division in the paranormal community.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, nobody right now has an answer. You know, we have theories and we have some, I call them pseudoscientific means of investigation, because we don't know that these methods pertain to, you know, what we want to capture.
Right. When you get an electromagnetic spike, is that really a spirit or is it something else?
Right. You know, did somebody key a walkie-talkie? Did somebody... I sat and watched an investigation. A mother and her teenage daughter were both on their phones, and I think they had Verizon because nobody else's phones worked where we were. This was at the Thomas House in Red Boiling Springs. Well, the teenager had the K2 meter on the table in front of her, and she sent a text message or posted something on Facebook, and of course that altered the signal, and the K2 meter went crazy, and she's like, look what it's doing, look what it's doing. I said, put your phone away.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting next to her. But and it's amazing to me that people can't figure these things out. But it's everybody has evidence that they either will or will not share. And if you don't share it, you know, you can't, nobody ever will figure out what's going on. And everybody's right. You know, This is I did this, look what I got. Well, you know, I have an interpretation of that. Because, you know, face it, some of the pictures that are posted online or that you see on television shows are very evidently not what they want them to be.
they aren't the orbs they're claiming that are
yes.
floating around.
Yeah. I have a game camera, which, you know, it's like a hunting camera. You can set it out.
It's a trail camera.
Yeah. I got it for Christmas. My husband knows that I love toys. And so I have the greatest picture. I set it up to take three pictures in sequence. Mainly I was tracking the animals that come through to my yard to eat the scraps that we put out. There's the greatest picture while I'm flipping through. It's on full screen on my computer, and I'm like, what's that? You know, it's this wispy thing that's in front of the camera. Well, in the next picture, it's a mayfly that had landed on the camera, and one of its legs in motion had taken this awesome photo. And I'm like, what's this? What have I got? Oh, I got a bug.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty much knowing how your equipment works and and how infrared reacts, you know, when it's taking photos, and something that's really, really, really up close to the camera lens looks like it's huge. It's going to be blurred because it won't focus. And it's, some things are taken out of context.
Is that right. The blue one at the blue ghost at the gas station?
Well, I was telling him about the picture that I got. But yeah, the blue ghost, now, I still can't figure out what that is, but I'd love to know.
It's a damn bug on that. The lens.
Yeah, I think I saw that on Fact or Faked Paranormal Files.
Yeah. It's a blue bug on the lens.
Well, actually, the wall the camera was mounted on was blue when they looked at it, so it was actually catching some of the color there. But it's all an interesting point. I mean, I believe from a point of view of faith that spirits are real and spirits exist and there is a spirit world. I don't know for sure that you can actually photograph a spirit. But that doesn't mean that I don't have that belief. You know, that belief is not based in photographic evidence. Right. I think these photographs are fascinating. And as you say, most of them we can explain away with some other explanation. But, you know, it doesn't have to be photographable in order for it to still be a real thing.
Right.
See, I've caught way more on audio than I ever will in video or pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a friend who has caught audio at a drive-in. Went to a McDonald's drive-in and pulled out his EVP recorder and was actually catching EVPs on the thing.
Yeah, so where, you know, where are the voices coming from? I think EVP is a fascinating phenomenon. The question is, you know, where are those voices originating? That I still don't know.
See, I love the people who claim that, you know, oh, well, it's just, you know, it's radio waves. Well, digital recorders don't have an antenna. So the same way that it's radio waves. And explain to me why Edison caught EVPs on his metal cylinders when there was no such thing as radio.
Hmm.
That one does fascinate me.
Yeah, Thomas Edison actually caught EVPs when he was...
That's something I had not heard about.
Yeah, when he was working... with his original system just recording sounds, he caught EVPs. And there's no way it was radio interference because there was no radios. He was inventing the radio.
Yeah.
It's the guy who is known for, I can't even remember his name, but he was recording bird sounds and picked up voices in the middle of the woods.
Well, you know, that's almost one of the things that I put off to pareidolia, because in the woods, there are more things going on that something might pick up. And if there are numbers of birds that overlapping, you know, the brain making patterns, just like, you know, I can look in the reflection of my computer and make a pattern out of what I see. But I have weird hobbies like that. I still look at the clouds and make bunnies and stuff out of them.
Yeah,
you know?
You have weird hobbies like that, especially now since you're unemployed.
Hey,
all sorts of free time, huh?
Don't knock the unemployed, okay? I'm one of the huddled masses now. But the bird sounds with voices in them. And, you know, we grew up in the woods, so you can hear things and not hear what you think you're hearing is what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
See,
you know, that's certainly, you know, could be the case. I've heard that, you know, that we always, we have a need to look for patterns and look for meaning.
It's physiological.
right. And, you know, in some ways that I think that's good. The question is to, you know, to kind of balance that out, I guess.
Right. You know, now, if I had been able to record when I was in my teens and 20s, I could lay in bed at night and listen to someone walking up the stairs in my house. Now, I know it's an old house. I know what it sounds like when it cracks and settles. But there were 16 stair treads, and there were 16 footsteps, and then footsteps in the bedroom above me. So if I could have recorded that, There's no pattern to that. But, you know, mm-hmm. didn't think about it, recording it back then. It was just what went on in our house. This was way back before Ghost Hunters.
Right.
Yeah, you knew what it was, but you, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, those types of things, you know, certainly happen. I was born and raised initially in Pensacola, Florida. And Pensacola has a huge history of, you know, ghost stories and haunted houses and just all kinds of things like that because of, you know, the old houses there and so on. And the downtown area in Pensacola, where a lot of offices and professional buildings are, is composed mainly of old kind of antebellum, you know, mansions and so forth that have been converted. Mm-hmm. And my mother worked at a law firm as a legal secretary when I was a child, and would go there often and work, you know, late at night doing extra work, catching up or whatever. And she would take me with her. Well, this old house that was what this law firm was. It was a two-story house, you know, dated back, I'm sure, to at least to Civil War times. And a two-story house with sort of, I guess, a hallway that ran down the middle of each story. And then the bedrooms or other rooms on the side were now offices. So working there late once at night, we were there in her office, and we heard the front door open and shut. It was very distinctive. You couldn't miss it because the door was kind of old and had glass panes all around it. So when the door opened and slammed shut, you could hear it, and it kind of rattled, and you sort of felt it through the old house.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother tells me, go and see who that is. Well, I wasn't really excited about that, but I went downstairs, and I as a child, I was kind of afraid of the dark, so I had to turn on the lights before I went into a room, and turned on all the lights as I went down, and I went to down to the bottom floor, and there was nothing there. Lights were all off. No one was there. The door was closed, and the door was locked. And so I went back up and told her that there was no one there. She kept on working, and I was, you know, playing or doing something. And later that evening, we heard it again. You know, definitely very specific. It would shut and slam, and the glass panes would rattle. She told me again, go see who that is. So second time, very, very slowly and cautiously, I went downstairs, turned on all the lights as I was going, went to the door. It was locked. I unlocked it, opened it, and looked out. Nothing. Everything was dark. No one around. So I went back and told her there's no one there at all. The door was locked. So she said, well, maybe it's time for us to go. So we left and went home. The next day, she asked some of the attorneys there. She said, you know, last night I heard something. It seemed like the door was opening and shutting last when no one was here. And the other attorneys there said, you know, sometimes late at night we hear sounds like that as well. So, you know, you hear these things. And it was, you know, there was no mistaking it. There was no imagining it. It was both of us hearing it, and we both immediately identified it. But no one was really opening and shutting the door. So what were we hearing? Well, you know, I think that remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing when stuff like that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, growing up in a home where things like that happened, I think as I got older, I had just become accustomed to it. And now when something like that happens, it fascinates me. You know, everybody's like freaked out and scared. And I'm like, okay, come on. Let's.
Right.
I walk in somewhere and just say, bring it. Let's see what's going on. Of course,
it's interesting, and I think that, you know, the paranormal investigations, that's one response to it. It's a great thing to do. But I think that, you know, a lot of this is in the realm of faith and religion and belief. And so it's interesting to see what different religions, what their take on this might be. So that's kind of where I come in.
That is cool. That's an idea for a well. Tell us about your books. Do your books deal with this?
The books actually don't. Okay. The books they are about the history and the archaeology and cultures of Mayan sites in Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Oh, wow.
And they are the results of studies that I did and travels that I took with my co-authors to these areas, going through and exploring them and trying to find things out. And the whole point is basically to relate what we know about the ancient Mayan history and culture on these sites, relate them to the story and the events in the Book of Mormon. Because a lot of Mormons take tours and go to these areas and think of these areas as, you know, the setting for the Book of Mormon. So the question was to kind of go down there and see what types of similarities we really might be able to find, and also to kind of do a site-by-site guide. So every one of these sites, you know, Palenque or Tikal or Chichen Itza, whatever, has its own chapter and has our own, the accounts of how we got there, what experiences we had, plus its history and archaeology, and then things which are similar there that, you know, similar to things that we read within the Book of Mormon. And so that was the, you know, kind of the initial starting point for those books, and that was their purpose.
All right. What do you say we take a couple minutes, go to commercial, and we'll be back?
That'd be great.
All right.
On the go and missing another one of your favorite Z-Talk shows? Now you don't have to. Simply go to the Google Play Store on your Android phone and download the Z-Talk Radio app. The best part is, it's absolutely free. That's Z-Talk Radio, only found in your Google Play Store on your Android phone. Download it today.
I was there in the winter of 64 when we camped in the ice at Nashville's door. 300 miles our trail had led. We barely had time to bury our dead. When the Yankees charged and the colors fell, Overton Hill was a living hell. When we called retreat, it was almost dark. I died with a grape shot in my heart. Say a prayer for peace for every fallen son. Let me lay down my gun. Sweet Mother Mary, I'm so tired, but I can't come home till the last shot's fired. In June of 1944, I waited in the blood of Omaha. 21 and scared to death, my heart pounding in my chest. I almost made the first seawall when my friends turned and saw me fall. I still smell the smoke, I can taste the mud as I lay there dying from a loss of blood. Say a prayer for peace for every fallen son. Set my spirit free. Let me. Shots fired. I'm in the fields of Vietnam, the mountains of Afghanistan, and I'm still hoping, waiting, praying I did not die in vain. prayer for peace for every fallen son. Shots
fired. Say a prayer for peace.
Mother Mary, we're so tired, but we can't come home.
No, we can't come home till the last shot's fired.
The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Z-Talk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
All right, we're back, and Therese is going to mute herself for a couple minutes while she goes and braids her husband's beard.
I'll see ya.
That's just... Daniel, are you back with us?
I am. I'm just not quite sure what to say about braiding someone's beard, so...
Yeah, that's one of those of, you're going to do what?
Huh? I haven't heard that one before.
Now, I put your... the links in the chat room to get your books on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody listening who's not in the chat room, it's an LDS guide to Mesoamerica and an LDS guide to the Yucatan. You want to tell us a little bit about those books?
Certainly. The an LDS guide to Mesoamerica was the first one that we wrote. And it was after my friends, my two co-authors and I had traveled and kind of gone around the Yucatan Peninsula, because we'd love to get together and talk about actually similar to the types of things that we're talking about right now, and especially about other areas and ancient cultures and things. And we eventually decided to say, hey, let's just, you know, go do a trip there. And I had been there once before, and I speak Spanish, and I said, sure, I'll take you around and show you where to go. So we did one trip where we flew into Cancun, rented a car, and just basically drove around, kind of did a circuit of the whole entire Yucatan Peninsula, visiting the sites that we'd planned, and actually one or two that we hadn't heard about that, you know, we kind of made some detours there. And then the next year, we decided to do that again, but we kind of ramped it up a bit, and we flew into Guatemala, and then went pretty much all over Guatemala, southern Mexico, and Honduras, visiting sites there. We also climbed an active volcano near Guatemala City. And that's quite the experience, let me tell you. But shortly after we got back, we were asked to sort of prepare a presentation for our church on our experiences. And we put together a quick PowerPoint presentation with images and video and graphics and so on. And we began to talk about our experiences and the things we studied and learned and show these things. Did that a couple of times, and people afterwards would come up and ask us, are you writing a book about this? Well, after hearing that a couple of times, we thought, well, why not? You know, but maybe we should. So I kind of began that process, and it was taking all of my notes and things and turning that into putting that together for a book. And we were writing about our travel experiences. We had some very interesting things, you know, getting from one end of Guatemala to another. And eventually we're able to finish up a book. We got a publisher in Utah that was publishing it for us. One interesting thing is that as a digital artist, I was working on all the images and the photos and doing all the layout and design for the book. So I was taking care of that. And about a week before we had to get the files done and sent to the printer, the publisher asked us for a page count. So I went through and did a page count and gave it back to them. And they said, oh, that's way too much. You know, we can't do something at this price point with that many pages. So I spent almost all of one night going through the whole book, seeing if I could trim it down to fit with what they wanted, and I couldn't. What I ended up doing was I kind of cut it in half. And so the first book, which is An Elder's Guide to Mesoamerica, is about our second trip, which was Guatemala, Mexico, and Honduras. And so I'd pretty much written about, you know, the trip to the Yucatan, but I cut that part out entirely and then just did the, you know, the one trip and the sites that we'd visited there. And so that was printed. It's hardbound. It's full color. We have photographs of all the sites. We're really trying to give it a good flavor of what it was like to visit them if you've never gone there. So that was the first book. And then a couple of years later, I decided to see if we could, you know, get the second one out. And so our publisher agreed. I had actually found a lot more information about some of the sites, decided to do more research and rewrite some things, but it was mainly all there. So I put that together. The second one, An Elder's Guide to the Yucatan, is currently an e-book. And you can purchase it as a download from Amazon, or it can also be purchased as a download or PDF, I think, directly from our publisher. So we have one e-book and then one physical book.
And the other one is also available on Kindle, right?
Yeah, I think they're both available for okay. Kindle. Although I will say that from my experiences, the Kindle format seems to work best for things that are mainly, you know, text-based. So ours, having a lot of graphics and a lot of images and things in there, doesn't quite translate that correctly over to Kindle. You can still get that, but I would recommend the actual book itself. Like I say, it can be downloaded from our publisher's site, and I think that they do it as a PDF, which can be read on any reader and keeps the format of the book, you know, perfectly intact. All the images and all the layout and graphics and all that.
So we have a
Kindle, you have a lot of options.
We have a Kindle laying here, and I just downloaded the reader for my computer and just used that because I actually, it's a bigger screen. It's like twice as big, three times as big. So it's like, I'll just use my computer.
Tablets really can't replace everything a computer can do. There are certain things, you know, like a real keyboard and a full-size screen that's kind of hard to replace that.
That, I'm always scared I'm going to drop the Kindle.
Yeah.
Oh, you know me. I would drop the Kindle.
Well, anything like that I have.
I was looking at it the other day, and it slipped out of my hands and smacked me in the face.
For mine, I have a little kind of a cover for it. It's like a little case with a wraparound thing to kind of protect it. So if it does get dropped, it has some protection. So any little device I have, I try to get some kind of case for it. I figure it'll give it, you know, protection from some knocks and bangs.
Oh, yeah, yes. with stuff anymore, you have to. I mean, come on, you drop your cell phone on the floor, your phone breaks. You drop an old Nokia on the floor, and it goes through concrete.
Yeah, I have an old Nokia flip phone. I will not trade it in for a smartphone.
Yeah, drop it on the floor. I dare you. You'll break your floor.
I have dropped that thing 100 times. No, I don't need a phone that's smarter than me, for one. I can't afford to replace them. So, but yeah, I have an iPod Touch, which I could download books on, but the screen's only 4 inches wide. So it's like, yeah, no.
That used to be my old cell phone, man. I couldn't imagine reading on that. It was hard enough trying to look at naked pictures on it.
Good Lord. So no one's ever heard of beard braiding before, huh?
No.
I've heard of it. I just didn't know it was done.
Well, my husband shaves his head every day, but he carries it down from his chin. So when he goes to work his security jobs, he likes to have it where it's not in the way. I braid it for him. Welcome to the wacky world of the West.
Ay, ay, ay.
Hey. You've seen pictures of my husband's beard, Chris.
Yeah. He looks like he should be on Duck Dynasty.
No, because they all have hair on their head. So. He would not fit in. But yeah, okay. Books. Back to the books. I'm sorry. I got us distracted.
Squirrel.
Squirrel! So, when, how long were you actually down there, before you wrote the book? Because, I imagine, you know, to get enough for a book, you'd have to be there for a couple of months.
Well, no, actually, the longest trip we did was, maybe like 7 or 8 days.
Oh, that's not bad.
And so, yeah, so it was, I mean, we covered a lot of ground each day, did a lot of traveling and saw a lot of, you know, a lot of places, and we're really all over there. In Guatemala especially, we just kind of went where we needed to. It was pretty, you know, pretty unplanned. So there were times when we would just, you know, camp out. If we had no other place to go, we'd just camp out that night and keep on going the next day. But a lot of the information that went in there was, there was a lot of study. So a lot of getting all the books by major Mayan archaeologists, reading all their stuff, doing a lot of searching for the published papers, going through that, and kind of compiling and putting things together. So that's really where all the time was spent. You don't need to be actually in the country that long to do that kind of research. I mean, most of the archaeological work is done by universities and things based in the United States. And so, you know, the information, a lot of it is up here.
Yeah.
Not that easy to get, but it is up here.
Oh, yeah. They keep saying they're trying to make that stuff easier to access, but I swear they're not.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, much of the work being done, the findings, as they're doing the excavations for these sites, they're only published, you know, say, within publications within that university. So they're not really widely disseminated. So there's a lot of stuff that is being found out, but, you know, only sort of in very limited academic circles. And there is there's what's called, I think, the Palenque Roundtable. It's in Texas. It's Austin, someplace in Texas every year where the Mayan archaeologists get together and kind of share their latest findings and papers. And that's a big thing within that community. But most people don't really hear about what, you know, what goes on or you know, what the latest is.
Yeah, and, you know, unless you're, you know, a member of one of the research things, you don't even know they're going on, so.
Yeah, exactly. Every now and then there's something, you know, makes the news. In the past few years, there's been a good deal of interest in Mayan history and archaeology, and so there'd be more programs that have been on things like the History Channel or the Learning Channel, things like that. Every now and then, something hits the news. I remember seeing something about a site that I visited my last time in Guatemala called Canquen, kind of in the central region of the country. And the big discovery there was they had discovered this area in the city where it was basically, once they excavated it out, it turned out to be an artificially built aquifer or kind of like a large area for water they think was used for ritual cleansing. But the elite of that city had all been murdered and their bodies dumped into that structure.
Yeah,
and so that had when during a time when the city was attacked and overrun, you know, in ancient times, and so that was something that actually made, you know, general news a couple of years ago. So every now and then something comes out like that, but most of what goes on, you know, isn't heard unless you're really following the archaeology very closely.
Oh God, yeah, and you know, archaeology is very interesting. One of our friends actually just came back from what? 3-week trip in frigging Egypt,
mm-hmm.
Doing research on the Exodus. Him and one of his friends, who actually lives in Egypt, have this little thing going on where they're trying to figure out when the Exodus occurred, and they're 80 years apart from when they think it happened. But they discovered evidence to prove both of their theories. So they're trying to figure out which one of them's right.
Yeah, tricky stuff. And that's a fascinating thing. I think Egypt and ancient Egyptian archaeology is fascinating. You know, the trick is trying to, you know, match it up. You know, does the actual archaeology from Egypt match up what what you know, the Old Testament would say. So that's, I think, still a very open and interesting topic.
Well, and you know, because about 2-3 years ago, they had discovered that the original translation about the Exodus was wrong. It wasn't the Red Sea that they had crossed. It was the Reed Sea, which was a tidal sea.
Mm-hmm.
And they went through and they redid the translation and found out that it was wrong.
I remember hearing about that. I think, if I recall, the Hebrew for that term is Yam Suf. And the trick becomes, when you have these words that are so ancient, how do you translate them into a modern language, and what part are they really referring to? And that's not an easy task all the times.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, so all this time we were thinking Red Sea, and maybe it was some other location.
Yeah, the Reed Sea was actually a tidal sea, and every day the water would, just like with, you know, the regular tides in the ocean, would rise and fall. That's how they were able to get across. And what they figured was that when the Egyptians tried to follow them, they got stuck in the mud because they were all on chariots.
Well, I think, you know, that's one possibility. I've heard some other things about the whole Red Sea, Reed Sea thing that suggests that that's not the only interpretation. But I think it does show that, the final understanding of these events, you know, isn't here, and that it's always good to look at new information.
Oh yeah, that's, and you know, that's the best thing about archaeology. There's always going to be more history to go through and look at.
Right, and sometimes it contradicts what you've believed for a long time.
Well, yeah, science tends to do that with religion.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. For how many thousands of years they thought the Earth was flat. And then the Catholic Church thought that the, you know, for a couple thousand years, thought that the Earth was the center of our solar system.
Yeah, and you better not say anything to contradict it.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Copernicus and Galileo found that out.
Yeah. Get charged with heresy, and it turns out you're freaking right.
Yep. Yep. So, yeah, I just think that, you know, it's a good thing when I think we're in an age where hopefully there's an atmosphere of, you know, of open discussion, of interest in other ideas, and of comparing different ideas and being open to, you know, re-examining things. That certainly was not, you know, the history for, you know, medieval times or much of ancient Europe. So I think we're lucky to be in a time now where there are a lot of different ideas around, but I mean, that gives you choice. That gives you freedom to, you know, look at all the various things that are out there and try and find out what works for you and what you think might be right, without having any negative repercussions because of that.
Okay, now, I've been dying to ask you this since, you know, we started, and I actually held off for a couple of minutes, which Jenny's probably shocked of.
Uh-huh.
Which, she doesn't even know the question, but she already knows I'm shocked, or she's already shocked. So, what is the Mormon views on aliens?
On aliens? That is a fascinating question.
And, I wondered that myself.
That's a fascinating question, and I think it's very interesting that you brought that up. Now, I'm wondering if you know that sometime recently, in the past few years, the Vatican made an official pronouncement that it accepted the possibility of life on other worlds?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that I think also that the grace of Jesus Christ could extend past this world to others. And that was taken as a pretty big announcement, a pretty big, I guess, you know, concession or acceptance on the part of Christianity. Well, it was actually taught, in the mid-1800s by Joseph Smith that this world we live on was not the only earth or world created by God, and that there were many worlds that were created by God, and that there were children of God living on those worlds as well. and that the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ was not for this world only, but it truly was universal. And so that's been a part of our understanding and acceptance for a long time, that we would accept that this earth was not the first thing ever made, that it wasn't made out of nothing, that the universe has existed for who knows how long, you know, billions of years or whatever, and that there are countless creations of God all around, including other habitable worlds, and that there are people on those worlds that have a relationship with God, and that, you know, they are just important as well. That's about all that we could say that we know from our doctrinal point of view. But like I say, it's certainly, we accept that is a true possibility. Have they come here? Are they visiting us? Are they abducting people? I don't know. But we would say, yes, there are other worlds where there are people living on them. We are certainly not the only ones in the universe. So hopefully that answered your question.
Well, when you brought up earlier the messages from heavenly beings, mm-hmm. or heavenly messengers, mm-hmm. Do you feel like that maybe there's a correlation there? That's when I got interested in asking the question, and I completely forgot about it.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because there's this whole ancient astronauts idea that the ancient people, you know, saw aliens visiting and thought they were gods, and that's the origin of a lot of this stuff. So I would say we don't have any kind of definite doctrines about that, but just trying to piece things together, I would say, you know, there might not be that much need to make a distinction. You know, how would an angel travel from God's presence to our earth? I don't know. Does he need to do it in a vessel, some kind of ship, or can he do it some other way? I don't know. But there's not really that need to make a distinction. I mean, for example, if you look at the word alien, we draw an imaginary line in the sand and say, if you live on the other side of this line, you're an alien. Well, if God or angels live in some other place physically in our universe, I mean, that would make them technically aliens to us if they're not on this planet, but, mm-hmm. you know, they're still related to us. So there might not need to be that much of a distinction. And the truth is that the word angel, people have this concept in their mind of what an angel is, but the actual word that's used in the Bible, whether it's Hebrew or Greek, in Hebrew it's malach, it just means messenger. And so, you know, the Bible will say malach Elohim, and that's a messenger of God. We believe that angels aren't beings that are really different from us, that angels are our brothers, that they are children of God just as we are. They're just in a different state of progress. And so they are sent from God's presence to our earth to give us messages or to explain something. And of course, the Bible is replete with messengers of God that come to give their messages to mortals, to prophets, to, you know, Mary, for example, to the woman who came to Jesus' tomb when he'd resurrected. And they're never described as anything other than people, you know. That's what we would say, are these aliens? Well, no, we would call them our brothers from the presence of God, you know, and they come here in some way. Do they have a spacecraft? I don't know. I don't have that. But you think about it, you know, right, you know, today, with the technology we have, we could be seen as gods to primitive people from a long time ago. Was it Arthur C. Clarke that said any, you know, technology is indistinguishable from magic to people who don't have it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, does God and do these angels and other heavenly beings, do they have a technology and understanding and a perfection that we don't have? And we call it, you know, magic or miracles, but they'd understand it in a different way just because we aren't to that point yet. So, you know, that's hopefully I got around to, you know, shedding some light on that. But, you know, our belief isn't just, you know, limited to this earth. If you think about the idea of medieval Christianity, and the earth is the first thing ever made, and it's the most important thing, and everything goes around the earth, which, of course, is ridiculous. You know, we are hopefully having a belief which is universal and encompasses all the beauties and grandeur of the universe and all the possibilities that are out there and all the things that science is now telling us.
Yeah, we're actually going to a Paradigm Symposium this year, and that is completely all about ancient aliens. I mean, they have Giorgio there from Ancient Aliens, which I actually can't wait for because I'm going to walk up to him and go, dude, your hair. I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens.
Yeah, why? Does it always look like that?
He just got it cut. He just got a haircut, and it still looks, it actually looks freakier.
Every time I see him, I think, does he do that on purpose?
I don't know. I'm going to ask him because...
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating question.
But, yeah, we're going to that this year. One of our friends, actually, and we've had him on a couple of times, Scotty Roberts, we just went and got his new books. I finally have his first book. You know, we just went and got his one about the reptilians. His first one is actually about the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
And I still haven't started that yet. Scotty can't kill me. But, yeah, he's of a firm belief that, you know, angels came down and mated with humans and...
Right, yeah, I've got my own responses to that type of issue. But something interesting about the whole ancient astronauts thing, and I'm not saying it's impossible, and I'm also saying that, you know, the ancient peoples and ancient cultures, they're probably far more advanced than we would ever suspect. And what just these little bits we're getting from their remnants of their civilizations thousands of years later, we just don't really understand them. But, you know, so there's some fascinating things there. I think there are still some questions about, you know, what went on and how and why. But something that people are saying, there's a popular thing that is brought up a lot, and I believe Eric von Däniken has mentioned it. I'm not sure if this is from Chariots of the Gods or later on, but it's the tomb of a Mayan king named Pakal. And this was in a very famous site called Palenque, visited a lot. It's a beautiful site to go to in Mexico. But his tomb was just discovered around the middle of the 20th century, buried deep inside a pyramid. It was, and the passageway down was filled in with rubble. They took a couple seasons to kind of clear it all out and get down to the tomb. It's one of like the greatest finds in Mayan archaeology, is the tomb of Pakal, and the lid to his sarcophagus has been something that ancient astronaut theorists really like, and I think I've heard Eric von Däniken mention it, but it has this huge slab of stone covering a sarcophagus that weighs tons, and it has this huge, very ornate carving all over it, which they seem to believe it's him on basically piloting a spaceship. Well, I'm not sure that that's really what it is, but if you look and see what Mayan archaeologists have to say, and what the actual Mayan culture and their iconography says, it actually seems to be very much a representation of his belief in his own resurrection and his path from the underworld of death through the tree of life, which was created by the death and resurrection of a god, up into the heavens beyond. And in fact, I have some very detailed information about that on my chapter in Palenque in An LDS Guide to Mesoamerica. And so fascinating as the ancient astronaut idea is, I think what it's actually saying is perhaps even more important.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's one thing that I find interesting is one of his theories is that the whole reason that some of the angels were kicked out was because they decided to go against God and try to mate with the women of Earth, and that was how you ended up with fallen angels.
Yeah, and I mean, Zechariah Sitchin has talked about this, and he's brought in with his things and the Anunnaki. You know, we actually have, this is referring to a very specific passage that's in Genesis, immediately preceding the account of the flood. And I think this particular passage has been misinterpreted. I'm not really sure how angels could have sex with women and produce offspring, but the term that's used about these, you know, these angels is B'nai Elohim, the sons of God. So the real question is, who are the sons of God? And, you know, that's open to interpretation. The Bible never literally says that it was divine or angelic beings. It just says they were B'nai Elohim, sons of God. And one interpretation of that could be that sons of God were people of the covenant, people who were following God, and that they were leaving people of the covenant and going and marrying women from outside, and they should not have been. And so, you know, if you take Occam's razor, which is easier to explain, which one is harder to explain. So I don't go with the angels coming down and mating with humans and having hybrid offspring. I go with the fact that this particular verse is maybe perhaps talking about men who were patriarchs, who were after the order of God, who were looking for wives in the wrong place, perhaps. So less exciting, I know, but perhaps more likely.
And, yeah, given, you know, let's see, what, 40 years ago it was legal for whites to marry blacks? And yeah, that mm-hmm. would make sense. I mean...
Mm-hmm. And I've even read, you know, just that is one interpretation that some, you know, Christian writers have come up with, you know, to not have to go with the, you know, angels coming down because they thought human women were beautiful and mating with them. I mean, that brings up all kinds of physical questions that I'm not sure people are ready to talk about. But, yeah, I mean, there's you know, these are types of things that, you know, can seem mysterious. And I think another perspective on it is helpful.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's one thing is, as much as people want to argue it, no matter what, religion doesn't have all the answers. And mm-hmm. then again, neither does science.
That's true. You can't really, you know, stick to one and ignore the other.
Yeah, too many people tend to do that.
Sadly, we've seen that. I think it's especially right now, it seems to be a great polarization of religion against science. And there are loud voices on either side, and they're not really helping us, I think, you know, come to the real truth about things.
Oh, not in the slightest. I actually have a friend who about 2-3 times a week we actually get into an argument. Now, he claims to not be Christian, yet everything he says is from the Bible. So I get into this little argument with him, and then I point out the fact that, you know, it says the same exact thing in the Bible, yet he doesn't claim to be Christian, so...
Yeah, I mean, is you know, is the Bible an infallible source to go to?
Oh God!
You know, yeah, maybe not. So, but you know, whatever your source that you're going to depend on, I mean, I think you should, you know, accept the repercussions of that.
Well, see, one problem that I have with most religions, the way that their books, you know, whether it be the Quran, the Bible, they kind of focus towards, because you follow it, you are going to heaven, everybody else is going to hell, and almost all of the old ones are about women being inferior to men, which has pretty much been proven wrong, because let's face it, if men had to give birth, the human species would die.
Yeah, I've heard the one that if you ever heard that if a married couple had to take turns having kids, no one would have more than three, because the woman would have one kid, and if the guy had one, he would say that's it, no more. So
Yeah.
Well, I think when you're dealing with very old books, like especially the Old Testament, I mean, it's written from a different culture, from a different point of view. And that may have made sense back then, but that doesn't mean that it holds true for today. So you have to kind of keep that in mind. And that's what I would say.
And you have the people who still follow it blindly. Or the ones who pick and choose the stuff that they want to follow, which is what a lot, every Christian religion does that. They pick the stuff out that they want to follow.
They do, because if they followed everything exactly as it is, it'd either be impossible or it'd be impossible to live in the modern world. So, yeah, that is certainly true. So the question is, what do you accept and what do you reject? And that can be a tough one, I agree.
Yeah, I'm sorry. If you're going to follow one, you have to follow everything that's written in it. And I actually pissed somebody off a couple days ago because me and one of my friends, you know, the same friend, had this conversation. He goes, "What do you have against religion?" I said, "Because it's basically a way to keep people down." Well, you know, not every book is like that. And I'm sitting there pointing out, I said, "Well, the Bible, you know, women shall not talk in church, so basically every woman has broken that, so therefore every woman is going to hell." That's like,
my mother left her church family of about 30 years because they hired a female preacher.
Interesting.
Yeah, she just didn't think it was right. And now, of course, there are women preachers, priests, pastors all over the world. But yeah, she didn't follow it, and she couldn't listen to her.
And that's one of those where it's not even, you know, that the minister, that pertains to everybody. Women shall be silent in church. That doesn't mean just no female preachers. That means all women must shut up in church.
Well, I think there are, of course, you're referring to the New Testament. And one thing I think is interesting about, you know, this original Christianity, the apostolic Christianity, is that for the most part, what we're getting is we're getting one person's view of it, and that's Paul. Not a whole lot of writings survive from the other apostles. I mean, how many were there and how much you know, do we have? So a lot of all our stuff comes from Paul. I wonder if we had had a lot of writings of other apostles, what they would say. Would they give us a slightly better or different viewpoint? So kind of keep that in mind. And so this kind of Pauline Christianity, as it's termed at times, I wonder if maybe that's not the fullest perspective of what really went on. I don't know. So I think there are lots of questions. That's kind of one thing to keep in mind, that, you know, it all comes from one guy, and every now and then he says some things that, you know, seem a little bit, you know, controversial or a little extreme.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, and, you know, that's one thing. And me and Teresa have actually talked about this a lot, is the Gnostic texts.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, they rewrote the New Testament and rewrote the Old Testament for the King James Version, what was it, 82 books were left out?
Yeah, the question of what to include in the canon and what not to include has been, that's been for, you know, almost 2,000 years, that's been a question there. And so, you know, our belief is that the Bible doesn't contain all the truth of God, that there are things that were left out that should have been in there. And so we believe that other books we have, like the Book of Mormon, are things that have been given to us to kind of, you know, replace some of this lost information. Now, for most Christians, the idea of having something in addition to the Bible is just, you know, they can't really comprehend that. No way. But we think that, you know, there are all these writings and all these things that have happened that, you know, there's a lot that if God wanted to let us know, that we could know. So I don't see any point in not taking a look at some of these things and seeing, you know, is there something good there?
I'm sorry, my sinus is just kind of blocked up on me.
'Tis the season.
If you suffer from that, then I guess that can be the case. I don't have any problem with hay fever or allergies, but my wife does, and so every time spring comes around, she's not doing so well.
Well, I'm sitting here in front of the window, and it's, you know, 80 degrees in the house and like 20 outside, and I just got a blast of cold air, and it's like, oh, my sinus is blocked. We still have like 2 feet of snow on the ground.
Oh, wow. Yeah, don't get that much where I am right now. Don't get any snow.
That must be nice.
That's okay. Tennessee doesn't get any either.
I actually miss the seasons. One thing I liked about Utah was, you know, it was a very beautiful fall and a very, you know, definite winter. If you hate the snow, you wouldn't like it, but I always kind of liked the snow.
I love snow. I'm still holding my, or crossing my fingers, because one of the largest snows we ever had here in East Tennessee was in, like, the middle of April.
Well.
So, I'm still holding out for that, but... everybody else has threatened to, like, stuff me in a box and hide my body. My friend hates
snow. Yeah,
my friend hates snow, and I'm like, come on. It's wintertime. We need snow. It's the only good reason for it to be cold.
Right.
I don't want snow. I'm sick of snow. I want spring.
You moved to Minnesota, dude.
Yeah, really? I still got snow in Pennsylvania. It snowed there the other day.
But
2 days after the first day of spring, I'm talking to my mom. She goes, yeah, we got snow.
Ha ha! We didn't. We got rain.
So, damn it. I just had a question and then it kind of went, wee! Yeah. Okay, now we were talking about ancient aliens earlier. How does Mormonism view how so many different cultures in so many different parts of the world have the same building, like pyramids and the faces on Machu Picchu and the Nazca lines and stuff like that?
Well, nothing as addresses issues that specifically. What I can say is that our belief would be that all cultures and indeed all religions would have come from a single source, and so you can look at things that are very widely dispersed in time or in place from one side of the world to another, and you can find similar beliefs and similar practices. We believe that could be because they come from, you know, a similar source. I mean, the idea of a God dying and resurrecting, you can find, you know, practically all over. The idea of a fallen being, fallen from the heavens and becoming the adversary, you can find all over. The idea of ritual cleansing with water, you can find all over. So we would believe that could be traced back to a common source, and that the true religion was actually given to Adam and Eve. And they taught that to their children, and it sort of disseminated in one way or another. Specifically with things in the ancient Americas, the whole point of the Book of Mormon is that people came from the old world, guided by God, and came to this new world and began setting up civilizations here. So if that's the case, I would suspect that some similarities would not be surprising to find. But the Book of Mormon talks about three different groups specifically that came here at different times in different places, and it's the account is mainly of one of them. You know, the way that the Old Testament might be an account of the House of Israel and their origins, the Book of Mormon is about this group that came, the majority of it anyways, about a group that came from Jerusalem to a promised land and escaped what was going to happen there and came here. And so, I guess, if that's the case, then you'd expect to find some similarities here and there. And there may be a lot more contact between the old and new world than just that. I know that science for a long time has completely denied that that can happen, but that idea is starting to become more and more accepted. You know, for a long time it was denied that the Vikings ever made it here.
Yeah.
And there was one guy that just based on their sagas and traditions thought, no, they had to have come here. Well, now they know that they have. The question is, how far in did they get? You know, is the Kensington Runestone, is that a real Viking artifact left behind, or is it a fake? I mean, you know, in the area of Minnesota and all that, you have all these things that claim to be, remnant of the Vikings. And so there are, you know, little things here and there that kind of stand out like that. For example, it's pretty definitely accepted that in some Egyptian mummies, very ancient, they found residue of cocaine and tobacco in the body tissues. Things that only should have been in the Americas thousands of years ago. How were Egyptian pharaohs having that? So, we don't have all the answers, but the Book of Mormon does say that there were some groups that came from the Old World to the New World. And so we would expect that there, you know, some cultural traits might have been brought along as well. Our belief is that, for example, there is in many cultures in Central America and South America, there's the belief of a white god, one who descended from the sky and taught them many things and brought them peace. And there are many names for this god. Quetzalcoatl is an ancient Mexican name. Kukulkan was a Mayan name for this being. Viracocha was his name in Peru. Well, there could be some common origin for those. And the Book of Mormon actually says that Jesus Christ came, descended from the sky and visited people here. And so if that's the case, we might expect to find little traces of it, you know, thousands of years later, that there's some similarity. So again, we don't have definite answers for all these things that you mentioned, but based on what we would accept as being true, you'd expect to see things like that.
Right. Well, and you know, too, the Vikings were pretty much plundering marauders. They were strike and leave kind of warriors, but what's to say if they found a vastly unpopulated area and wanted to expand that they didn't stay and move, you know, 1,000 yards inland from the sea.
Right, and they did set up settlements, you know, mm-hmm. as they were coming across, towards the New World, they were setting up, you know, permanent settlements where they stayed for a while. So, you know, you have to kind of rethink, you know, the old beliefs sometimes if something new comes to light.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's funny, I had just gone out in the living room for a second, and this is something that I figured I would give you a chance, and it has nothing to do with the paranormal, but I figured I would give you a chance to, you know, inform people a little bit more, because you were talking, a lot of people don't know much about Mormonism, and, you know, a lot of people still think that Mormons have not only multiple wives, but underage wives. And I go out, and they're talking about Warren Jeffs.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
So would you like to explain to everybody a little bit about, you know, that practice?
Okay, the polygamy and all that? Okay, I can certainly do that as best I can. These are things that, our belief really is that our religion did not start with Joseph Smith. We don't look at him as being a reformer or a protester against any existing religion. Our belief is that he restored the true religion, which was given to Adam and Eve, which was given by Christ and his apostles taught. So we believe it as a restoration. The whole idea about plural marriage is that, you know, if you read in the Old Testament, you have indications of that, where it seems like, you know, the guys that are the heroes of the Old Testament, the good guys, are having multiple wives. So our belief is that this was a principle that was restored, among others, through Joseph Smith, that it was a true principle of God, that at certain times and at certain places, it was to be practiced, but always under kind of, you know, God's control, so to speak. And so, of course, Mormons, for one reason or another, became unpopular in the settlements where they lived and kept moving farther and farther west. And that's why Mormons ended up in Utah, is that they couldn't find safety any other place where they lived. So they continue the practice. We actually call it plural marriage because they believe that it was a practice that was ordained by God to be used in certain circumstances, and there was a need for it. And it was discontinued in the late 1800s. And it was discontinued by the prophet of the church at that time. Well, there were some groups that, I guess, disagreed with that. Now, if I were to be asked, I would have thought, great, it's discontinued, we don't have to do it anymore, wonderful. But there were certain little groups that didn't accept that, and so they sort of removed themselves from the church and kept living that. And many times they are kind of have evolved into Warren Jeffs and the groups that are around today. These people have never really been Mormons. They've never been part of our church, and they haven't for many generations. So and because they're so isolated, weird things tend to happen. In the case of Warren Jeffs, he's doing things that are illegal. He's doing things that are just awful, and there seems to be no control or nothing to it. So, again, these are groups that splintered off a long time ago and have kind of kept to that, and they felt that plural marriage should still be practiced, that, you know, the prophet couldn't say, okay, the time has come, we're going to stop living it. And the problem, you know, if you have, you know, when you hear things about young girls that are forced into this, I mean, so you have statutory rape, you've got abuse, and all kinds of horrible things, and even things where, you know, abuse spreads in those little communities. So, you know, they've never really been part of us in anything in the modern sense, and, you know, they might have a similar origin, but they're not what we would consider Mormons or Latter-day Saints, and so they're very separate from us. So we believe that the privilege or the time to live this has been revoked by God, and I'm glad that was the case. But yeah, there are certain little groups that you know, still keep doing it. So they finally caught Warren Jeffs, and he's in prison, right?
Yeah, he's in prison, but he's apparently still... His little community that he started, he's still in charge of it, so...
Yeah, well, I mean, the people will do what they do. I'm just... But if people break the laws, and especially if they're abusing children, you know, I say, you know, let's go after them with the full force of the law. And so these people are living it in a way that it never really was lived initially. Especially with, you know, with the age of the girls that they would take. And also, a man didn't decide he was going to take another wife and decide who it was. It was, you know, the way it worked was that it was a calling given to him. Here is another wife you need to take and add to your family and take care of her. When you have men that are deciding on their own, I think I'll take another wife and go look for one, I think that's just sort of rife for all kinds of abuse.
Well, and I think also the families decided at times it was a way to make sure that their daughters were taken care of. one thing I wonder about that is studying world regional geography, you go through populations where there are population shifts between male and female to where if possibly this plural marriage started as a means to populate, if there were a larger population of females than males.
Yeah, I think that certainly could be the case. Now, our belief is that it wasn't a decision that someone came up with. I mean, with the opposition, the persecution Mormons were facing, to come up with something like this would be the kind of the last thing you'd want to do. So our belief is that they were commanded by God through the prophets to do it. But, you know, if you're going to talk about why, that could certainly be a good reason. You know, a lot of people died as they were forced out of their homes and sometimes in the middle of winter and made their way over to, you know, a new place where, you know, they couldn't be troubled. And that's, again, why they ended up in Utah. And so at that time, you know, a woman on her own would have had a very hard time surviving. So it could have had some practical uses and some practical applications, again, for that. I can't say that we know really all the reason. Our belief is that it was correct and it was a commandment of God for the time, and mm-hmm. that that it has been revoked, if you will. And I know that I, for one, am glad that it was, and I can imagine that most people were when that happened. But like I say, there were certain little communities and groups that didn't accept that and continued to still live it. And I think what they're doing now has gone far afield from what it was originally, and right. to where you hear some really horrible things where, you know, laws are being broken and women and children are being abused, and it really has become something that it should not be.
Well, you certainly will have your Warren Jeffs and your David Koresh's and your Jim Jones.
Yeah.
Any number of fundamental, and with all due respect, nut jobs.
Exactly, yeah. I think that's certainly true.
That just take things into their own hands and say, well, okay, God told me to do this.
Yeah, and that's the trick, you know. If someone sets himself up as a prophet and he's saying that, is it from God or is it from something else?
Right.
And, you know, that's for the individual to decide. It's a matter of faith, but I think it's also one where, you know, common sense, there's a place for that as well.
Okay, well, we are almost out of time. We have another guest coming on in a couple minutes. Do you want to go ahead and plug your websites, and then we'll go to commercial?
Sure. I've got a blog that I set up initially about the books. It's called ldsguide.blogspot.com. But it has a lot of other information there. As I'm doing research into all kinds of topics, I have information there. I've got PDFs you can download for free. It's got links to presentations and talks that I've given about things that have to do with ancient American history, some artifact stuff, how this stuff might relate to Mormon beliefs, and some of the usual questions that people bring up. You know, there's a lot of information on my website. There's information about the books, PDFs you can download, and things you can watch. And you can also get in touch with me, and, you know, I'm happy to communicate with anyone that, you know, would like to do so.
And remember, both of his books are available on Amazon, The LDS Guide to Mesoamerica and LDS Guide to the Yucatan.
That's right. Also available from our publisher directly, and that's Cedar Fort. They're in Springville, Utah. Almost any places that sell books, I mean, there are other places as well. If you search, you can find that as well. But, it's something that a fascinating topic for me, and I love to share, you know, what I have to offer and hope it can be useful to someone. And I love, you know, sharing ideas, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to two of you and, you know, to hear more.
Well, Jenny's here. She's listening. She's just not working.
So we do two radio shows, so I'm trying to split it up here.
She's trying to focus on booking guests because we're running out of guests for the next couple of months.
Yeah.
She's got us booked up until May, and she's booking us now till it looks like freaking September.
Love it.
Well, that's how it has to be done.
It's absolutely been a pleasure talking to you tonight, Daniel.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been the same for me, and I hope it's a good show for you. And if there are more questions you have, I'd certainly love to do it again sometime if the opportunity arises.
Well, I will be emailing you sometime this week for the magazine article. So.
Okay. Yeah, great. I'll be looking forward to seeing that. I'll get back to you on that.
All right. Well, it was great having you on. Thank you.
Okay. I thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Now, we're going to take a commercial break, and then we will be back with Dr. Rita Louise.
An old man whispered in my ear, 'twas the saddest thing he knew. When Ireland's proudest son was shot at the age of 32. He held my hand, his eyes held tears, and my eyes filled up too. With a powerful emotion for a man I never knew. Michael Collins, fearless son, he touched the nation's soul.
still achieved your goal. 'Twas not behind the barricades you fought the wanton fights. You beat the enemy at their game. You undermined their might. Was in a crowded banquet hall, the old man, meek and mild, a simple man from off the land, with the blue eyes of a child, brought a memory that an Irish gun shut down the rebel sun, and Ireland lost her laughing boy before his work was done. Michael Collins, fearless son, you touched the nation's soul. 10,000 pounds upon your head, you still achieved your goal. You knew the orange and the green would keep us yet apart, but the dream of Ireland one and free was the dream that filled your heart. In a banquet hall some 50 years gone by, held a sadness that would never pass, in his blue eyes filled to cry, with the memory that an Irish gun shut down the favorite son, and Ireland lost her laughing boy before his work was done. Michael Collins, fearless son, you touched the nation's soul. 10,000 pounds upon your head, you still achieved your goal. 'Twas not behind the barricades you fought the wanton fight. You beat the enemy at their game. You undermined their
On the go and missing another one of your favorite Z-Talk shows? Now you don't have to. Simply go to the Google Play Store on your Android phone and download the Z-Talk Radio app. The best part is, it's absolutely free. That's Z-Talk Radio, only found in your Google Play Store on your Android phone. Download it today.
The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Z-Talk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
All right, and we are back. It was nice having Daniel on. I got to remember to contact him later this week.
Very, very interesting conversation.
Yes, very. And on with us right now, we have Dr. Rita Louise. How you doing tonight, Doc?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Would you like to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I do so many things that it's like, well, pick a topic that you want me to kind of talk about. I am in my day job. I work as a naturopath and medical intuitive. And so I work with people who are having health issues and want an intuitive assessment of what's going on physically. And so that's what I do for my day job. I do energy work and intuitive counseling. One of the other areas that I work in is, I do ghost hunting, and I've written several books, which I'm hoping we're going to talk a little bit about those today, and host my own radio show, Just Energy Radio, that airs on Thursday evening on the Inception Radio Network. And I write a lot. My newest thing is I've been making these little video learning things, and they're like 10 minute videos with graphics and music. I mean, they've been coming out really good. I've been impressed with myself, which is very hard to do.
sorry.
And so, you know, like my radio show has a YouTube channel, which is Just Energy Radio, where you can get the shows as well as these little vignettes. Or if you just are interested in these video learnings, I made a separate YouTube channel for them, which is Science and Spirit Meet. That's Science and Spirit Meet. And I have like 6 or 7 of them up, as well as a series of chakra meditations that people can listen to online and experience health, healing, and wholeness in their lives. Woo-hoo.
Oh, no, that would be cool. I've gotten very interested in the chakra cleansings and evolving, I guess.
Well, you'll have to go check it out.
And that's on Science and Spirit Meet on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with, you know, subscribe to that. Check it out. Definitely.
I mean, I must be doing good because I've only had that channel, I'm going to say, for about 2 months, maybe a little over 2 months, and I've already gotten requests from people of topics that they would like for me to cover. I'm like, dang. That's pretty good, I think.
Now, tell us a little bit more about medical intuitive, because I've never heard of that before.
You've never heard of that before?
No.
So a medical intuitive is a person who, I'm just going to take it down to its very simplest form. A medical intuitive is a psychic who talks to you about your health. And so even under the umbrella of medical intuition, there are, you know, there are differences, kind of like under the umbrella of psychic, there are differences. The way that I work is that I look in people's bodies. I'm a very visual person. And so, you know, I'm able to see, you know, is there inflammation here or is there swelling? Like, as an example, my husband for the last month has been suffering from really bad respiratory stuff. And so he went to the doctor and they said he had pneumonia. So they gave him a bunch of antibiotics. And I try to stay out of his business because he trusts mainstream medical. So I just try to stay out of his business. But the medication they gave him didn't work. I mean, he wasn't really getting any better. And I, you know, so then I kind of involved myself and I said, you know, it doesn't feel bacterial in nature. It feels fungal. So I got him some herbs that were more fungicides and he got a little bit better, but not enough, you know, but I didn't have him taking mass doses of these herbs. And so he finally went back to the doctor. Actually, he went to a different doctor. And again, they said it's bacterial. They gave him more antibiotics, which did nothing. So then he ended up going back to a different doctor like a week later because it was kind of getting worse. And this doctor gave him an antifungal versus an antibacterial. And guess what?
Went
it's
away.
All clearing up.
Oh, gee, what a shock.
And I would, you know, and he goes, yeah, they gave me an antifungal. I go, well, haven't I been running around for the past month saying it's fungal, it's fungal, it's fungal?
I'm sorry, you have to go to medical school to be a moron.
Well, from a external place, you know, from just an observational place, an x-ray, they appear the same. You know, it's like they look on the x-ray, they see this big white glop in your lungs, and they go, oh, you have a pneumonia. What's the most common reason you have a pneumonia? It's because it's bacterial. But as a medical intuitive, it's kind of like you develop a library of if somebody has something, it will appear kind of in like a you know, for me, in like a library symbol. So, for example, if somebody has something that's bacterial and I ask the question, you know, is this bacterial? Is it fungal? Is it, you know, mold? You know, what is it? If it's bacterial, I will see kind of like a petri dish, you know, like you see on TV.
Yeah.
And there'll be these little cells and they're like reproducing all over the place. And that's my like library symbol for bacterial. And if it's fungal, it's kind of like moss hanging on a tree. You know, it's just kind of there and wet and thick. And that's what I was seeing in him. I wasn't getting that there was, you know, this little petri dish going on. It was more the forest, wet, mossy thing going on, which is why I said fungal.
And here's a newsflash for you guys. Men don't listen to their wives ever. Ha, 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 ha. Until it's the very last avenue.
Well, actually, he listens to me okay. I really try to stay out of his business because his background was in mainstream medicine. I mean, he worked in mainstream medicine, so he trusts it. So it's like, you know what? You do that, and when that don't work for you, you can come to me, and I'll give you my 2 cents.
I'll put my two
cents. Usually tends to work.
I'll put my 2 cents in, knowing that there will be a waiting period. And within 2 or 3 days, usually, my 2 cents comes back and he adds 5 more. And it's like, okay, told ya.
Right. But exactly.
I have the large character flaw of my 4 favorite words in the entire English language are, I told you so.
That's every woman's. Who the hell are you kidding?
Well, but I...
No, I don't say that to him. I just run around going, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good.
Oh, I saw a shirt today that I so need to get. It said, I wear the pants in this family. And then under it, it said, when I'm allowed to.
Which is never. Which is never, ever allowed.
Hey, no. That's okay. I've already decided on my headstone. It's going to be carved. Told you I was sick.
Yeah.
I may die, you know, 50 years from now. Damn it, I told you I was sick.
The hypochondriac's tombstone. Told you I was sick. But yeah, I've actually squelched my I told you so down to where it only comes out like on a really, really good I told you so.
So when did you discover that you had that ability?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to be psychic. I mean, that was kind of like a goal, and I would read all these books on astrology and numerology and pretty much anything I could find, but I didn't really think that I was psychic. And so much, much later, I found the Berkeley Psychic Institute and started studying with them. And after being in their program for 3 weeks, I realized that I had been very psychic my whole life, and many of the situations that happened to me that I just thought were these really weird coincidences, in reality, was me having a psychic experience. You know, taking that a step further, I was working at a New Age fair, a wellness expo. It was the Whole Life Expo in California, and I was sharing a booth with a girlfriend of mine who was halfway through chiropractic school. She and I had gone to Berkeley Psychic Institute together, and she went back to chiropractic school to finish up her chiropractic degree. And I had a woman come into the booth who was having this severe back pain. And my body tends to be really kinesthetic. And so if your head hurts, my head hurts. If your back hurts, my back hurts. And I'm trying to work on her, but I'm in excruciating pain because I was having a lot of lower back issues at that time.
Yeah.
And so kind of telepathically, because my girlfriend went to go get something to eat or something, I'm like, Kim, come back to the booth. I need your help. So she finally turns back up, and I'm still working on this woman. And I thought, you know, because of her training, that she would go in and start adjusting this woman's back, like energetically, not physically, because, you know, that's illegal until you're, licensed or whatever. Mm-hmm. But energetically, because you can do that, use energy medicine to adjust someone's back. And she would do that, which she didn't do. She started doing all this other really, to me, weird stuff. And so she was doing that, and I started working on this woman's back to the point that she started feeling better. And that's when I realized that seeing things and recognizing things on a physical, functional level was something that came very easy to me. You know, and it's kind of like, you know, some people are clairvoyant, some people are mediums. You know, for me, looking at and seeing inside people's bodies just comes very natural. Kind of like talking about relationships, but relationships are funner than talking about health.
Oh, God.
Well, they're more
gossipy. She wants to talk about relationships. Yeah. No. No, Jennifer, well, no.
But it is fun.
Yeah, well, read that couple. I dare you.
Oh, dear Christ. Even Dawn Short's scared to do that, okay? I sent her a message last week because she does picture readings. I sent her a picture of me and Jenny together where I've got this really creepy smile on my face, and she still hasn't messaged me back. Even Dawn's scared to.
Good.
Okay. Anyway, I'm not even going to touch that one.
Well, we, the owner of Z-Talk, Scotty Rorick, is psychic, and mm-hmm. we constantly pick on him because we had a reading done, and he said that I would be here in 6 months, and 6 days later, I was on a bus here, and I messaged him, and he goes, well, I had the six right, and I said, I knew you were going to frickin' say that.
So you're psychic, too?
That's exactly what he told me. He goes,
but, you know, psychic
too.
isn't about being predicting dates. You know, it's about exploring where the energy is and where it's going and where it's moving and flowing. You know, and so, you know, when somebody asks me, like, am I going to do this? You know, I can tell them, kind of yes or no in a general sense of the word, and I'll come back to that, you know. But if they ask for a time period, it's kind of like you can go out and go, well, this is where the energy is, and kind of give them a window. But it's not, you know, people think, oh, well, you're going to read my mind, or you're going to say, like, on next Tuesday this is going to happen, you know. But we all have free will, and it doesn't work that way. It's more about probability. This is where your energy is. This is where you want to go to. And so based on that, what is the percent chance that you're going to achieve it? You know, but sometimes we don't take in all of the other factors, you know, of what's going on. You know, I've had people come and ask me about their business. You know, I mean, I had somebody ask me about that, like right before 9/11, you know, like a couple of months before 9/11, you know, and it was a new business, and based on what was going on and based on her ability to do marketing and be proactive about, you know, promoting her business and her inventory and the shop and the location and all of these things combined, the likelihood and the percent chance that her business was going to succeed was really high. And then 9/11 happened and everything changed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's impossible to factor in all of these unforeseen things that can impact the movement of energy.
Okay. Now, well, let's talk a little bit about your books. Tell us about your books.
Okay. Sorry, I just took a big sip of water.
That's okay.
And then, so I didn't mean to have like that dead air. So I have four books. My newest book is called Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. And it, you know, in a very generic way, kind of looks at the ancient alien question. And it looks at it from a mythological point of view. And so what we did in that book was we evaluated mythology from around the world and discovered that a lot of the stories parallel a lot of the other stories that you find around the world. And so when you place them together and kind of put them in some kind of chronology, you end up with a much more expanded view of our remote history, which you don't really learn in school. And they just barely touch on in shows like Ancient Aliens, you know, because they will talk about this myth here and this myth here and not put them together so you can see kind of the whole story. And so that book has been really exciting to write. It has been extremely well received. I mean, shockingly well received, which makes me very happy. And so that's that book. My other book, and this is called Dark Angels, An Insider's Guide to Ghost Spirits and Attached Entities. That book we have just recently re-released, actually just a few weeks ago, and have finally released it in the Kindle version. You know, so if people are interested, the new version as well as the Kindle version are now available on Amazon.com. And that book You know, it looks at, it's broken up into three parts. The first part looks at ghost hunting or ghosts, because this book is about ghosts, because I'm a psychic investigator. You know, it's from a psychic perspective, talking about the different kind of ghosts that you might encounter. It's very story driven about, you know, me going into different locations, but I'm kind of a chicken. And I'm scared of the dark. And it's not that the ghosts scare me. I just don't like being in the dark. And so, I'm really upfront about it in the book. And so I tell this one story about the haunted bed. You know, we were in Jefferson, Texas on an investigation, and we were doing an overnight. And the owner of the place said, well, maybe you could go sleep in the haunted bed. And I'm like, why does everybody put me in these haunted things?
Because they know you're afraid of it.
No, because she wanted my psychic impression of the haunted bed. And so I made somebody else stay in the room with me. And we left the hall light on because we were both scared.
I'll tell you that I'm not afraid of the dark so much if I can see the surroundings in daylight. You know, like if you got a walkthrough of the house during the day or with the lights on, to me, if I was going to stay in that room when I know what's in there, it's not so bad. Just to sit, yeah. If you don't get to see it first.
Me and Jenny went to First Ward School, slept in one of the Lemp Mansion beds, which I still don't know how the two of us fit in a single bed. We have a hard time fitting in this thing, and it's a twin. But we slept in a single bed. We were at Edinburgh Manor. Slept in a bed where the owner actually had an experience. Another single bed. And you know what pisses me off? Everybody's like, how can you do that? It's like, nothing happened. I'm a little annoyed. oh, no, I can't say nothing happened because I did have that frickin' breath on me all night.
Yeah,
I had something breathing in my face.
Well, and you know,
it felt like a kid just standing there staring at me.
And that's what I was picking up, was the little boy, about 10 years old. I told you that. He was interested in you, Chris.
Of course he was.
But, you know, you're the wife or whatever, so he doesn't listen to you.
No, he does not.
She's just my girlfriend.
For now.
Girlfriend, whatever. Significant other, possible Q.
Yeah, well, and I'm laying there and all night, and it was no matter which way I turned my head, it was like it was standing next to me. I had checked, there's no draft, nothing.
Well, see, I wouldn't have got out of the bed. I would have just like curled up more, put the covers over my head, and called it good.
Oh my God, it was so cold. what was it in if the about 30 degrees, 40 degrees.
Yeah, if that.
It was cold. We had two blankets on us, and I slept with my hoodie on and gloves. And
I slept with my boots on.
Yeah, she slept with her boots on, and at one point I was tempted to put my boots back on because I woke up, my feet were cold. But yeah, we keep constantly sleeping in these supposedly haunted beds, and nobody has to tell us to. That bed's haunted. Cool, I'm sleeping there.
And everybody. We were the only ones who slept in that building that night.
Because Denise kept falling asleep in the command center. But
yeah, she was supposed to be watching us.
I'm the person who wants to, when we go to a hospital that still has the morgue trays, I'm sleeping in a morgue tray.
You're insane.
I'm not insane.
I've only gone to one morgue that they actually let us into the room with the morgue tray. And oh my God, that was a trip. Because what I kept seeing was like all these different bodies just like on the table until this one guy sat up, and that scared the crap out of me. That was, and I'm like, you know, I think I'll go in the other room now.
It's a little
crap. He didn't say anything. He just sat up and was like,
bye.
Gotta go.
It's a little crowded in here. I think I'll move out.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I like to say, you know, I haven't ever met a ghost that I didn't like. You know, they might be kind of cranky and drunk or whatever, but they're usually okay.
Why do I attract all the cranky-ass spirits who don't like me?
It's not just cranky-ass spirits.
I attract all of those people to me.
I'm a grumpy old man, and I'm not even 30.
You've heard that live on air, everyone.
I'll admit it. I'm cranky. I have no problem admitting that.
Yes, he is.
No. Now,
do not step between Chris and a cup of coffee.
Oh, God. You, Jenny found that out the hard way. I moved her. Be happy I picked you up and moved you, not just shoved you. Now, what has been the strangest place you've ever had an experience?
The strangest place. Well, this was early. This is before I did ghost hunting. This was before I knew I was psychic, but I had lived in a house. This was in college that had been, which I didn't find out till after I moved in, the town funeral parlor.
Oh, Jesus.
I lived there for a year. Well, you know, the story, I mean, this is how the whole tenor of the book is. So this is, you know, like early in the book, I'm kind of giving my story because I grew up in a house that was haunted. There was a the dead guy that lived in the basement. So, you know, everybody in my family knew about the dead guy, but nobody talked about him. And then when I went to college, I went to school in Oswego, New York. Now, Oswego had like an average snowfall was 13 feet a year. And so, getting an apartment that was on the bus line was really good because people really didn't drive. You would just leave your car in the driveway and it would just get snowed in. And then when it thawed, you take your car out again. And so having an apartment on the bus line was just really good because you didn't have to like walk a couple of blocks in the snow or the really heavy winds. They had really high winds there. And so this room, you know, because I was in college, became available in an apartment with three other people. And it was right on the bus line, and it was this cool old house. And in the downstairs, because it was an old Victorian, and in the downstairs, there was a business. And there was a big sign in the window that said mausoleum. And so I figured they sold some kind of floor covering stuff. I have no phonic skills. And so it wasn't until someone said, "They don't sell mausoleum. They sell mausoleums." And I was like, oh, okay. And it wasn't much after that that I went out drinking into this one bar that had a lot of, you know, what they call townies. People that actually lived in the town went to this one bar. And this guy asked me, you know, "Where do you live?" I said, "Oh, I live on the corner of Fifth and Bridge." He goes, "Oh, the old funeral parlor." It didn't get any better after that. And I only had been in there a few weeks. And in that house, okay, so there were four bedrooms. My room was the safe room because, you know, this is before I learned how to do energy medicine because it already was creeping me out being in there. And I, like, filled the room with bright light and put, like, energy protection on the door. And so, like, there was no way anything was getting in there. But that was, I mean, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just doing it to feel safe. But in the room across from mine, where this one girl was, throughout the course of the year, and this is no lie, I went into that room five times, because it was creepy. There were two doors into that room. Apparently, it had been a viewing room, and so the door from the main hallway, that's the door that I normally would go in my whole five times, but there was another door that went in from the living room into that room. And you couldn't even go by that door without like getting totally creeped out. And people would come visit us and they wouldn't come back. And you would be there and you'd be like sitting in the living room. And this place is so weird. Okay, so the way that it was set up is that it's this old Victorian house. And when you opened the outside door, you came into this little teeny foyer that had two doors. One went into the mausoleum business downstairs. And the other one, when you opened it up, it just opened up to a staircase that went up to our unit. And so on that bottom door, I hung some little bells. So, you know, if you open the door, it would ring the bells because it was really a blind corner. Well, there would be times where you would hear what sounded like the outside door open. You would hear this like of air from the compression between the doors. Mm-hmm. and you would hear the bells jingle, but neither of the inside doors would open, and then you would hear creaking up the stairs. So I would immediately turn the sound on the stereo up louder or go in my room. Yeah, that place was creepy. And, you know, after we left, because everybody that was in there, we all moved out the same time. And so my old roommates got talking to these people that moved in after us. And their question was, how come the hall light keeps turning on? See, we never turned the hall light off. It was always on. And so we never had the experience of turning the hall light off and having it turn back on because we never turned it off because it was too creepy.
You know, there are some places that you just, like the door you were talking about, you walk into this room, can be perfectly nice people there, can be all bright and cheery, but the hair on the back of your neck raises. You get a little shiver. There are places that I used to go with my sister that I refused to go back. It's like, no, don't want to go there. And these were like nightclubs. It's like you walk in and get hypersensitive. What I found out a little bit later is that the massive energy in this one place was known to have cocaine behind the bar, and you know, but you feel the desperation.
Mm-hmm.
The energy of it is, you know, there's 300 or 400 people in there, and all of them were there for pretty much the same reason in the '80s. You know, so we're going to go do this. We're going to go get drunk and find men, or we're going to go. You know, this is the way people think in that type of a situation. That I walked in once and left her there with somebody else. It's like, I'm leaving. I'm going back to my safe haven across town. But that feeling, like you were talking about, you walking past the door and you wouldn't go in her room more than five times. That's a kind of an eerie feeling when it hits you.
Oh, it was beyond eerie. I mean, I remember twice going in there and standing there talking to my roommate and going, I can't stay. I got to go. Bye. And I just turned around and walked out because it was just so
gotta bad. Go. If you want to talk, come to my room.
Well, I mean, there were a couple of situations that my roommates would end up in my room because it was the only place anybody felt safe. Like, okay, well, we'll just fill the room with that golden light.
Well,
put those little energetic crosses on the door, you know, whatever.
Do you think maybe that it was the power of suggestion when that guy told you that it had been a funeral parlor, that you didn't know that before? When you went back, was it even worse? Was it even creepier?
It was already, I mean, I hadn't been in there all that long, but we were already starting noticing stuff, and I already knew that that one room was awful, and I wouldn't go into it. It was toward the end of the year that we got a Ouija board some work. Well, I mean, you know, I was already reading cards. My roommate was already doing card reading. See, all right, so midway through the year, the girl that was in that room left because she couldn't deal with it anymore. And she was going through a lot of emotional stuff, and I know it was because she was in that room. And so this other girl moved in, but she had her own entity attachment issues, you know, so I think that kind of amped things up even more because now we had the ghost and her entities all hanging out. And so we decided to get a Ouija board, but we were doing it kind of scientifically as far as Ouija boards. I mean, we weren't looking to the Ouija board to get answers. We just wanted to communicate with the spirits, which I think is a very different thing. But we would always do it when there were three people available to do it. Two people would do the planchette, and then one person was the observer, and the other two people had to keep their eyes closed. But what was interesting is we would do it, and it would be like, we'd put our hands on it. Okay, can Valerie play? And it would go, yes. Can Patrick play? Yes. Can Rita play? No. I mean, it was very clear it did not want me there at all. So one night they got somebody else to come over to do the Ouija board. And I went to a party and got really drunk because I knew that they were going to do the Ouija board. And came home, and the information that they received is that there were three different spirits in the house, and one of them, I mean, I know now because, you know, with psychic stuff, you can kind of go back in time. One of them was the housekeeper. The kitchen, the room that was our kitchen, had been the utility room. Like, our kitchen sink was a utility sink. And so the kind of clanking that you would hear on the wall in the hallway was actually like his bucket or his tool thing kind of banging against the wall or something that he was using, you know, going down the hallway. But one was the spirit of this dead person who died in like 1890 something. And things got more active after we did that. But we only had 2 more weeks of school. So it was okay because we were all moving out. And we didn't care because we were going.
We're going to leave him here.
Yeah, pretty much. So I don't know how the other people that moved in after dealt with it after we stirred everything up. But I don't care. That sounds terrible, but I don't.
Well, I mean, since then, you obviously have some knowledge about Ouija boards, you know, the portal deal or the vortex that you can supposedly open. I think Ouija boards are tools, and that the reaction that you get, the activity you get from that is based on intent.
Exactly.
That's just my own personal conception of it or observations. So do you think that you can actually open up a means for, say, inhuman spirits?
I mean, it is possible, but there are a lot of pieces that go with it. You know, if you're just using it to play with and gather some information, I don't really feel like there's a lot of danger. You know, but there are people that will try to utilize it. I don't think as much anymore because it's gotten so much bad press. As a means of divination so that they can get answers to their life questions. I haven't had this problem with people using Ouija boards, but a very similar methodology has been people doing things like automatic writing, mm-hmm. you know, or calling in their angels or their spirit guides so that they can get answers to their questions. And they really rely on their life on this information. And I have seen people open up vortexes and have entities attached, and, you know, a couple of them end up with schizophrenic type situations happening, all because they weren't clear about who they wanted to communicate with.
Right. And some people that also just don't have an understanding of what they're doing.
Correct.
Correct. Let's go play. Okay, sure. Watch this.
Well, you know, and the biggest part is usually when we're desperate to get those kinds of answers, we're desperate.
Yeah.
And we have bad energy. And so we're calling out for anything that has any kind of light, that might have any kind of uplifting, any information. You know, we don't really discriminate when we're in a bad place. You know, so it's this combination of factors. And so what you might call in might have good and uplifting information for you in that moment. But when you come back and get back into your wholeness, maybe not so much. Or sometimes they trick you. It's like, oh, here, we're kind and shining. And then once they kind of lure you in and they open that vortex up, you're trapped, and the messages turn from being kind and uplifting to
we're going to go
mean and nasty. Yeah.
Yeah. The answer to your money problems are here's a gun, go rob the bank. And that's an oversimplification of it. But,
well, I haven't ever heard that one, but I could see that, you know.
Well, I, you know, like I said, over my years, I've figured out too that when I'm at my most point for answers is when I don't need them yet. You know, that if I sit and hang on for just a second, I'll get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but some people have, you know, the instant gratification that we need in our day and time. I want the answer now, and don't realize that, you know, it'll come. You just have to wait a little bit.
Or they don't or they don't trust their own stuff. And that tends to be the bigger thing, is that they don't trust what they get, and they will give up their power and give up their autonomy to some other being, who or whatever it may be.
And take the first solution that comes along.
Right, without really looking at the pros and cons. You know, and in more recent days, you know, there has been a lot of talk. I'm not really sure what the word is, but, you know, people saying, well, I call my angels in. You know, like if I'm going on an investigation, it's like, well, I surround myself with bright light and I call my angels in. And I'm like, well, what angels are you calling in? And if you say Michael to me one more time, I'm going to scream. Because, you know, is it Michael that lives down the street that committed suicide? You know, is it really Archangel Michael? How do you know? Because they don't even, like, check into the vibration of who they're calling in. They're just like, ah, it's Michael. You know, and they might get a name. But, you know, like in my family, we have like 7 Johns in my family. You know, right. So if there was an Archangel John, it could be my brother. It could be my nephew. It could be my other nephew. It could be my brother-in-law. You know, it could be my cousin. Could be my uncle. I mean, there's a million of them. So which one are you talking about?
Well, yeah. And if you're calling in Archangel Michael, you should be able to explain to me the hierarchy of angels and just exactly why you would want your Archangel Michael to come and watch over you tonight.
But there's also a feeling piece to it, you know, and a recognition piece. I mean, we can tell who our family is, you know what I mean, and close friends from their energy space.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And so if we've never met or truly interacted with Archangel Michael, then how can we recognize his energy in our space? And most people are not high enough advanced. I'm sorry, don't mean to be insulting to anybody, to have that kind of discrimination.
Exactly. And I have some sort of discrimination just because I'm old, you know. But you have to nurture that understanding and live with it and grow with it. To, you know, like I said, I don't go anywhere anymore where there's not going to be at least one of my friends with me, because I can't stand the outside force. You know, of all these people, I might make it an hour, I might make it two, but after that, I'm going home. And my husband's a musician, which makes it really hard for me to go out. It's like, okay, honey, have a good night. See you. You know, if you want to be able to recognize that, you know, that feeling in your, you have to pay attention to it.
You know, and ending up with an attached entity, you just don't want to, because they're a pain in the butt to get rid of.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that must be my attached entity friend in the background.
I had a spirit attachment.
She had an attachment for a couple of months.
A few months.
But see, that's not even what I'm talking about. And I'm going to use myself as an example. I had an entity attached for over 40 years.
Holy crap!
You know, and the most common place entities get attached to people is when they're children. The most common. You know, so I'm not talking about any flyby. I went to an investigation and I got some entity attached. I'm talking about these things that bury themselves into you and your psyche, so that you just assume that what you're thinking and what you're feeling is you, but really what you are talking about and what you're experiencing is the entity at work. And it there's a lot of discernment that has to happen, you know. And so I tell people, if you think you have an attached entity and no one said to you you might have an entity attached, then you probably don't have one. Period.
Yeah.
Do you think that the attachment to children is because that they're less questioning and more malleable, I guess is the word I'm looking for?
The attachment to children usually happens because to children that are in places of need. You know, entities only attach because the door is opened up. You know, so when you're playing with the Ouija board, and this is that fine, you know, differentiation, it's like the person is in a place of need. You know, they open the door. They're like, help me, help me, help me. And the entity attaches because they've been invited in. In children, once it had been physically abused, sexually abused, you know, whatever, emotionally abused, you know, whatever that situation is, you know, in foster care, you know, they're the ones that are in need. And so they are energetically calling out into the universe, help me. And they get help. They get help by this entity. And the entity helps them to deal with the trauma. You know, because when an entity is in your auric field, it gives the individual the opportunity to disassociate from the situation. So as an example, and I think you'll hear this, you'll hear stories of women that have been raped, but they have no memory, you know, and it's only through, you know, hypnosis and or through these little flash things, do they have any kind of recollection that something might have gone on. Well, it's not that they were, you know, like drugged or unconscious. It's because they disassociated from their body. And when we disassociate from our body, it's the opportunity for the entity to move in. I mean, that's what people that do full body channeling do. They disassociate from their body and they let the entity come in. And so, you know, depending on how far you allow the entity in will depend on how much control it has or and how much recollection you have. Individuals that have rage issues, you know, rage disorder, many times will have an entity attachment. And if you ask them, well, do you remember what you did or what happened? Most times they'll say no, or they'll just have a vague recollection. It's because it wasn't them in that rage.
Yeah.
So
very interesting. Thank you.
It's a really interesting phenomena, you know, and it's actually a lot more common than most people think, you know, and I believe people with like schizophrenia, certain kinds of schizophrenia, you know, and some other psychological issues, certain kinds of obsessive compulsive disorder are really victim to entity attachments and not necessarily some brain chemistry issue. You know, and I don't want to say in all cases, but a number of them.
Do you think that there is, watch me get on a roll here, any correlation, like, or a differentiation between the way that people with autism and, say, Asperger's relate to spirit entities, activity?
I don't have a lot of experience, or I haven't really thought about it that much, but I have a however. I have a definite however. I have a sister whose son is autistic. You know, you guys are going to laugh. And so she called me up one day and she said, you know, I have one of those plastic Santa Clauses that you put on your front lawn, and Colin goes and he talks to that Santa, but he doesn't really talk. You know, he like does whatever talk he does, which isn't really English talk. And he'll just stand there and talk to Santa. And I looked at it and I go, well, that's because Santa has an entity in it. Well, then they kind of escalated that Colin stays up all night because his little friends come and play with him. And she has four boys. And so all the other kids stay up and play with these spirits. So they had this whole house full of people. And I got my sister to actually get a team to go in. You know, it's one of the nice things about Facebook. You know, I got talking to this one woman who was part of a team near where my sister lives, and she referred me to a group that had a really good psychic on the group. I said, you know, they don't need the investigation as much as they need somebody to go in and do a psychic assessment of what's going on. You know, and if they want to film, go ahead. You know, because I knew she had all kinds of weird stuff going on at her house. So, and so I think they are more open. I don't think they're controlled by it.
Right.
Like someone with schizophrenia, but I think they might be more open, or the veil is thinner. More autism in the classic sense than Asperger's. But I can't really make a you know, a definite statement about the Asperger's.
Well, you know, it has been proven that some children and young adults with autism are highly intelligent. They just process differently. They learn differently, and they may not, you know, be prone to the stigma that comes along with the paranormal. They don't ask the same questions we do. Mm-hmm. So they would be more accepting and more open to, you know, say, oh, there he is. Who? You know, Santa Claus.
But he doesn't even talk. You know, he'll just like, you know, whatever he does. I mean, he doesn't talk. But, and I go, well, what does he do? He's like, he's having a conversation. I think she was more freaked out than I was freaked out. I kind of laughed. I'm like, ooh, yeah, he's talking to an entity, you know. So my sister has become much more aware of, you know, what that means and, you know, having boundaries in her house, you know, so if she wants her kids to go to bed, she will tell her son that he needs to have his friends go home and, you know, because it's time to go to sleep and they can come back at 9 o'clock in the morning, not before then. And I think things have calmed down. So that's a good thing.
I think the boundaries, too, is what a lot of people don't get. You know, they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
That you can, you know, this is the world of the living, and this is your area, your space, your house, that you can say, it's not okay for you to be here now, go to bed.
Exactly. You know, and the same thing with ghosts. You know, if you don't want them to take your keys, tell them, you know, don't take my keys, or, you know, put them back over here, you know, and have boundaries. I always think of, like, Caesar, the dog guy.
Milan.
Caesar Milan, you know, it's like rules, limits, and boundaries, or, you know, his little...
Rules, limitations, and boundaries.
You know, it's like, that's what you have to have with ghosts.
Well, we had one, pardon me, in the house that I grew up in, which is probably why I'm just so open to talk to other people and find out their opinions and what they've learned, because there was an apparition there. Now, I wasn't validated with this until my husband moved into the house and finally got to see her. And when we left the house for the last time, we moved back in when my mom was sick. And then after she passed away, we moved out. When we moved out, I said, okay, as I'm talking to my living room, here's the way things work. My sister's moving in. She's an alcoholic. If you choose to stay here, show up late on Friday nights. But I said, we're leaving. You can't come with us. So you can stay here if you want to, or you can move on and go do something else, you know. But we're going to be gone. It's been nice knowing you for 50 years, and see you around.
Have a nice life.
Have a nice afterlife, you know, whatever. But I did. I said, if you're going to show up late on Friday nights for me.
What, to scare the crap out of her?
Yeah. Yeah. And she was, I mean, she was benign. She just showed up. You know, she would, and that's probably the one that walked up and down the stairs at night. And she would stand by the front door, or she would stand by a window and look out.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband saw her once dashing down the hall to the bathroom, which is odd because she usually didn't stand downstairs. She was normally upstairs. But he thought my mother had gotten up. My mom had Alzheimer's, and she was prone to rambling at any given time. And he came into the living room and said, I saw our girl. And I thought, oh, good, she's up again. I'm going to have to go get her back to bed. You know, he's like, no, the other girl. I was like, oh, okay. But, you know, it's just, it's kind of cool. You see these things, and you grow up with it, and you accept it.
But, you know, just being able to have that kind of conversation with, you know, a spouse or a family member or a friend is so much better than having it where you're having this experience and you feel embarrassed telling somebody about what's going on, or, you know, getting any kind of confirmation. I mean, I remember a number of years ago when I was married to my ex-husband, my dog was being really weird, and she was sitting on the top of the sofa, and she was just kind of growling, which was weird. And so I thought she wanted to play, so I'm playing with her, and she jumped onto, she's very small, onto the top of the sofa and was growling and like looking at this one spot in the kitchen. So I turned and I looked, and there was this guy, I mean, obviously invisible, standing in my kitchen. And I'm looking at him going, well, who the hell is that? So in my own way, I get on the phone. Hey, there's this guy standing in our kitchen. Do you have any idea who it is? And there's a little pause. Nope, no idea. So that's my ex-husband. I go, okay, I was just checking. Bye. And I hang up. A week later, my son was talking to me. I was in my office, and where he was standing was in line where that man had been standing in our kitchen. And he's talking to me, and then he looks over and he goes into the kitchen. And he goes, who's that man standing in the kitchen? And I said, I don't know. Do you? And he goes, no. And then he paused and he goes, this is just what it's like living with you.
Well, my husband used to ask me, we were sitting on our bed upstairs watching television, and my back was to the window. There was a chair with a footstool ottoman next to it. And while I was talking to him, I said, there is a woman looking over my right shoulder, listening very intently to everything you're saying. Do you see her? And he said, this is verbatim, why do you only bring this stuff up when we've been drinking? I said, well, we drink a lot. You know, well, how else can I tell you about it? This is what we're sitting here talking about. And she's watching and listening to everything that you're saying. About 3 weeks later, I was asleep and he was watching television, and he said he looked over towards the window where the chair is, by the way, and there she stood. He said, I started to poke you and say, it's for you. So, you know, and that validation to me was awesome. Mm-hmm. Of course, then he started telling me about the stuff that he grew up with, and it made mine look like Disney World.
Okay, unfortunately...
Oh, no.
We are almost out of time.
Well, that was just way too fast.
Can we have Rita back?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, we'll get her back. Do you want to go ahead and plug your websites and stuff?
Sure. And so if people are interested in the services I offer, which include medical intuition evaluations, energy medicine, and psychic readings, or would like to get any of my books, you can go to www.soulhealer.com. That's S-O-U-L-H-E-A-L-E-R, soulhealer.com. And there's also, you can get a link to the radio show. I have some of the YouTube stuff on there in the articles section. And, Dark Angels, Insider's Guide to Ghost Spirits and Attached Entities. Spend a third of the book talking about attached entities. So if that's a topic you're interested in, that would be the book.
Cool. Is that available on Amazon?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and we have just released that book in particular on in a Kindle version.
Oh, cool.
I love my Kindle.
So yeah, we'll have to get her back on, Teresa.
I'll
have the secretary work on it.
It's been a pleasure, an absolute pleasure.
Well, same back at you. This was fun, and that hour just went by so fast.
Yeah, it did.
So, yay! Thank you.
I don't know where the hell the calendar is. It got torn off the wall last night. Who the hell we got next week, Jen?
That one.
Constance Heldari. Oh, we have a slot open for an hour for next week.
Yeah.
So. Well, who knows? God only knows who we'll have on.
Is that like a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of thing?
That's more like I'm almost scared to know who Jenny's going to get on.
Oh, okay.
Because she does that. She'll wait, oh, we need a guest. And next thing you know, I've got, like, friggin' Jay Lynch on, and we spend an hour talking about squirrels.
I'll, I'll do the nudge, nudge, wink thing if Rita's available next week.
Facebook me, and that'll give me a chance to look at my calendar. I don't know. It's been kind of crazy. Wait, what's today?
Wednesday.
Wednesday. Well, you know, because I'm going to be at a conference this week. You know, I live by my calendar.
Well, we got a show coming on, so we got to get off of here.
Thanks for having me.
This has been a production of the Z Talk Radio Network.